I'm going to make a phone call to see if we can get Mr. Christman on the phone, and then we will move forward. Before I make this phone call, let me ask you, is there anyone else that needs to be called this morning? Anyone else? No. Victims or anyone else? I just want to make sure that we have everybody. Yes, this is the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency. Will you be helping us with Mr. Richmond Christian this morning, sir?
Yes.
Is he available?
He is available. What do you want it? You're done? Okay. Okay, just 1 minute. We're going to go get him and get him to a phone.
Okay, thank you.
And then I will transfer you over to him.
Yes, sir. Thank you so very much, sir.
Okay. Just 1 minute.
Thank you.
No, Chief Justice, who's speaking?
Yes, this is Arizona Board of Executive Clemency. Are you going to help us with Mr. Christman's hearing this morning, sir?
I am. Would you prefer this over PA? Do you want to just talk on the headset?
We will leave that up to you on your end. That will be his determination because this is his hearing. If he wants it to be heard by others, he can do it. Or if he just wants it for himself, he can do that. That's his decision, sir.
All right. I'm going to just go ahead and hand the handset to him.
Okay, sir.
Hello?
Yes, good morning, sir. Would you state your name and your ADC number for the record? This is the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency, sir.
Okay, my name is Richard Allen Christman, and I haven't been housed in Arizona in almost 4 years now, so I don't remember my ADC number.
Okay.
I think it's,
Well, you don't have to worry about that. We just wanted to give you that opportunity because we know that you've not been housed in Arizona recently. Sir, this is your hearing today. This is a phase two hearing. Just for information, and I'm sure that some of your supporters have already informed you of this, back on October 26th of this year, 2017, the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency held a phase one hearing, commutation hearing, and at that time the board voted to pass you to phase two, and today we will be having the phase two hearing. During the phase one hearing, the board had a great deal of information provided to the board. The board understands, I believe, quite well what was said at that time, and the board has had an opportunity to review all of the documents that you have provided to us and that others have provided to the board. But just for your information, we have gone through phase one. Now we're at phase two. The responsibility of this board today is to make a determination whether to pass you to the governor. The governor will make the final decision if this board makes that recommendation and the governor accepts that recommendation. The governor does not have to accept the recommendation coming from the board, but the board will make that decision at the end of the hearing today. This will be phase two, and in phase two, the board would like to hear anything that you would like to tell the board and your supporters to tell the board. We're not going to limit it this time. The last time we concentrated a great deal on whether the sentence was excessive and some other things did come out, but this time we want to know the progress that you made. We want to go back to the original offense, and you just tell us, and the board wants to listen so that at the end of this hearing today, the board can make an informed decision. Therefore, we will get to you very shortly to ask you to give the board some information. At this time, I would also like to introduce you to the board members. We have three board members, panel members, participating in your hearing today. And they are the Honorable Ms. Gail Rittenhouse. Since you cannot see us, you can't see us, but you know who we are. The Honorable Ms. Gail Rittenhouse, The Honorable Mr. Louis Kiwanis. My name is C.T. Wright. I'm serving as board chair, and I'm serving as panel chair this morning. And on behalf of the board, we would like to take this opportunity to welcome you to the board. I would point out the fact that the order of the hearing this morning, and this is not only for you, but for those who are present today. And I would just indicate to you, we do have a room full of individuals here attending, and many of them will be participating in the hearing. But this is the order of the hearing for today. The board chair will make a brief statement, and it will be brief because we have gone through phase one. Following that, the board chair will request you, Mr. Christman, and or your attorney to make a statement, an opening statement. And following that statement, the board will have an opportunity to ask you and your attorney questions. That will be followed by statements from your supporters that's present, and they will be given that opportunity. The board also may ask questions. That will be followed by statements from the victims and the county attorney. At that point, the board will again have an opportunity to ask them questions. That will be followed by a closing statement by you, sir, and your attorney, and or your attorney. And that will be followed by a discussion of the board. And following the discussion of the board will vote. As you know, in Arizona, we operate under the open meeting law. Therefore, we will vote publicly. Our discussions will be held publicly. We will not go behind closed doors. We will make the decision publicly where we are, where the panel is as of this moment. Do you understand so far, sir?
Yes, sir.
Based on just very brief, based upon information that the board has, that the offense itself was committed back on October 5, 2010, and we take note that you have submitted an application, or the board has an application from the Department of Correction indicating that there is two offenses that are still listed, and they are, one is manslaughter, and on that one you received a 7-year sentence, and you are requesting a reduction of 2 years and 5 months. And according to information that we have from the Department of Corrections, that your earned release credit date is listed as September 16, 2019, and your sentence ending date is listed as September 18, 2020. And if this board were to accept your request, you would have already been released, and that would have been on August the 20th of 2017. The second offense that's listed is aggravated assault, and that was a 5-year sentence. And on that one, you are requesting a 5-month reduction of sentence. And the dates would remain the same. The earned release credit date would be September 16, 2019, and the ending date would be September 18, 2020. So far, is the information that I have provided, is this correct? Or is anything, any corrections that you and your attorney would like to make to what I've just stated, sir?
I would not. I believe that information is correct.
Okay, sir. So at this time, I am going to give you an opportunity. Before I do that, let me just say that those who will be speaking, we're going to ask each of them to come to the podium. Those who are in the room, we're going to ask them to give their name and then make whatever statement. And we're also going to ask, because of respect for time management, that we will not repeat over and over, and we would also ask that we will not repeat what some others have already shared with the board, just as courtesy to the board. We just like to show respect. So at this time, as part of the opening statement, or as the opening statement, Mr. Christman, do you wish to make that statement, or would you want your attorney to make that statement on your behalf, sir?
I think I would like my attorney to make that statement on my behalf.
Okay, ma'am, please come forward and state your name.
Yes, sir. Good morning. My name is Julia Castles. I'm the attorney for Richard Christman.
And welcome to the board.
Thank you.
And what would you like to tell the board this morning, ma'am?
We're here today on behalf of Mr. Christman, and as you can tell, we have a large number of supporters here. The room is full. I believe the lobby is full as well. Mr. Christman's case is a case unlike really, I believe, any other that has come through the criminal justice system here in Arizona. This is a truly unique sort of a case. The board hears cases weekly of other inmates who are asking for reductions in sentences or commutation or clemency. Mr. Chrisman is somebody who is completely different from any of those other cases. The offense occurred while he was on duty. The circumstances of that offense have been well detailed, I believe, in the previous hearing and in the materials that were submitted. Mr. Chrisman has accepted his sentence, I believe, with a great deal of grace and a great deal of class. The circumstances of his incarceration are completely different than any other inmate in Arizona. On that note, I will again ask that the board direct the room to be cognizant that his location is to be very protective. He is housed out of state due to security concerns and has not been in the state of Arizona, as just mentioned, in over 4 years. Because he is housed out of state, the way in which he is able to interact with his family and with his friends is completely different. Arizona inmates are able to spend time with their family in person, to have meals brought to the facility, to have hours and hours and hours of visits. In this situation, his family is driving to another state. They are not allowed to have a contact visit. Additionally, as of January 1st of 2018, the facility is changing the visitation. All visits will now be done via video, which means Mr. Chrisman's wife, his mother, his family will not only drive multiple hours, they will drive multiple hours to look at him through a video screen. This is incredibly difficult for the family, and especially for Mr. Chrisman, who has already served an extreme amount of time without being able to see his family, his wife, face to face. Because of the nature of his situation, he has further not been allowed to do things that other inmates would do. He is not allowed to go off campus, despite the fact that the facility believes he would be an excellent person to do so. The Interstate Compact prison laws do not allow for off-campus work by out-of-state inmates. The conditions of his incarceration, as I said, are different than any other. We are asking the board to recommend to the governor the deletion of the remainder of his sentences in this case. He has served a long amount of time on these matters already. I know that the board had the opportunity to review the letters that were previously submitted during phase one. A letter which I will draw your attention to again is the letter that was issued by the Honorable Judge Granville, who presided over these proceedings and over the trial. If you recall, Judge Granville noted that he believed that Mr. Chrisman's actions on that day were subjectively reasonable, and that he, if he had been able to, under the law, would have sentenced him to a lesser sentence. I have a few other documents with me this morning from other individuals who, I believe, weigh in on this same issue. They were not able to be present today. I would like to take the opportunity to read these letters with the board's permission.
Please read them, ma'am.
The first letter is from attorney Craig Marins, who is an attorney at the Marins and Wilmot firm. It's dated December 6, 2017, and addressed to the board. It reads, I was Richard Chrisman's trial attorney. Over the course of preparing for his trial, I spent a great deal of time with Rich and the people who knew him. The acts for which he stands convicted are truly out of character for Rich. He realizes that and knows that his conduct that day was an aberration. He has accepted those facts and the responsibility for his criminal conduct and the fact that he must be punished for his conduct. Prior to this situation, Rich was a loving father, a good father to his boys, as well as a good police officer, with the exception of this incident. If returned to the community, he will continue to be a good father and a productive member of the community. There is not one reason to believe Rich will reoffend. I have been a criminal defense attorney since 1965. I have represented many police officers in that time, some of whom have gone to prison, and I have seen other officers whom I have not represented incarcerated. It has been my experience that ex-officers do not reoffend. I have read Judge Granville's letter to this board. In my years of practice, I have not seen such a letter. I agree entirely with it. Rich has been fairly convicted and by now fairly punished for his crimes. I would ask the board to grant his petition for clemency. Sincerely, Craig McGrath. I also have a letter from Robert A. Nielsen. It's addressed to the Arizona State Board of Pardons. Mr. Nielsen is the education coordinator and instructor at the jail in which Mr. Chrisman is housed. It is labeled with the subject line of School Activities of Richard Chrisman. Dear Board of Pardons, this letter is written on behalf of Mr. Richard Chrisman, a state inmate currently housed, and I am redacting the name of the facility. Mr. Chrisman registered for our education program on May 5th, 2015, shortly after his transfer to this facility. At that time, he set his goal to improve his educational functional level to earn his adult high school diploma. We have requested a copy of his high school credits from the Camp Verde High School in Arizona, but have not received a response. Accordingly, Mr. Chrisman is working diligently to earn credits he feels he might need. I am impressed with his positive attitude and sincere desire to learn. He is extremely conscientious and detailed in completing his assignments. He is very capable and demonstrates a high level of competency in his work. He uses his time in class very effectively. He always goes to work on his computer immediately and stays on task until the class is over. His attendance in school is 100%, and he is a positive influence on others in his class. He is patient, has a friendly personality, which I appreciate, and makes it a pleasure to associate with him. He has proven to be an outstanding individual, and I look forward to his presence in my class. I feel Mr. Chrisman has great potential that will enable him to develop the skills and abilities needed to adapt to society and become a contributing and productive member thereof upon his eventual release. Thank you for your consideration. Signed, Robert A. Nielsen. That's actually a second copy of the same letter. I am also about to read a letter dated December 4, 2017. Signed by Sergeant J, the initial J, Lugers, L-E-U-G-E-R-S. I, Sergeant Lugers, I'm redacting the location again, take pride in having opportunities to write recommendations for deserving inmates. Although I have written very few, inmate Richard Chrisman is one deserving of such a letter. I think we all know that trusting is a huge no-no in this line of work, so I use this word very carefully when I say it. Mr. Chrisman has held a trustee position in our facility for many months and has exhibited his ability to follow directions and also lead others into doing the same. He goes above and beyond his calling and helps out wherever it may lead him or where we may guide him. His position requires him to be up early every day, and he has done this without fail since day one. He is dedicated, knowledgeable, and committed, showing us through his day-to-day actions. Although it would mean losing an excellent member of our offender team, there are few that meet his level of respect and his level of perseverance. I hope you take into consideration this letter and know that Mr. Chrisman has raised the bar when it comes to the position which he now holds, one that I can't see being performed greater. Thank you for this opportunity. That's signed, Sergeant Lugers. I also am holding a letter from the Arizona Department of Corrections, which is signed by Tom, I'm not sure how to pronounce this, Lyera, L-Y-E-R-L-A. And it's a letter written in response to an inquiry that was made. It reads, and it's addressed to Mr. Chrisman, I am in receipt of a recent undated letter. I agree that you would be a good candidate to work in the community. Unfortunately, it's prohibited by policy and is non-discretionary, so an exception cannot be made. That is in response to what I addressed earlier about the possibility of Mr. Chrisman doing work. I also have a letter which was drafted by the Prison Ed Foundation. It is a letter directing Mr. Chrisman as to how to proceed with his educational efforts while he is in custody. While he was in custody, Mr. Chrisman did earn the high school diploma, and he has continued to work well within the facility. So he has taken advantage of every opportunity that was afforded to him while he was in custody. Unfortunately, those opportunities were quite limited due to security concerns and to the interstate compact in regard to prisoners. I have two other letters from other individuals, and then I will cede the floor over to the family, friends, and colleagues who are here that wish to speak. The first letter is signed Jennifer Sevilla. It reads, to whom it may concern, My name is Jennifer Sevilla, and I am the daughter of ex-officer Richard Chrisman. I am writing this letter today to tell you a little bit about my dad. It's been a while since I've been asked to write about him, and a lot has changed. I've gotten a car of my own, I've gotten a great job I never thought I could have, and I've moved out of home and now started a new home. Before even getting a car that I bought with my own money, I asked him what I should do or if I should do it. Even though he is not with me, he has been able to help me through a lot of different things. He has helped me make decisions that no one else would be able to. He assured me I would do great in my new job. And thanks to him and his encouragement, I have been able to get not one, but two promotions in my new job. I have missed him like you wouldn't imagine. I wanted him to be there when I got the keys to my new car, or when I came home and let everyone know I got a new job, when I got my first and second promotions at work, or when my boyfriend asked me out. I specifically needed him there to make the choice to accept to move in with my boyfriend. I needed my dad to help and guide me through that. I wanted him to meet him and tell me if he was right for me or not. It's just not the same over the phone. I've needed his hugs on many occasions, and I haven't been able to get any for 4 years. And even the thought of having him back home is too overwhelming to think about. I hope you take into consideration everything we have all missed out on due to something that happened. I want him to be able to come home to us and be able to spend my next birthday with me, or to spend his next anniversary with my mom, or to see my sister go into high school. There is too much that he has missed already, and I do not want him to miss any more of it. I want him home, and I know that sounds selfish, but it's been too long that I've been able to hug my old man or watch him blow his birthday candles out in a long time. He hasn't even been able to kiss my mom, and that breaks my heart. Overall, this experience, I think, has helped us grow as a family and be united more than anything. I know that we will get through anything even more now than ever. This is something I never thought I would have to go through, but I am. And to some point, I am grateful for it because it has made me and my family stronger. Thank you again, and have a blessed day. Sincerely, Jennifer Sevilla. And then I just have one for the letter, prior to seating the floor. It reads, to whom it may concern, I met Richard Chrisman just over 18 years ago at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church. He had just had his first son, and I'd also just had my first son. His then wife and I spent every Sunday morning in the mother's room together during church services, becoming fast friends. Our friendship grew outside of church around the beginning of the year 2000. We would have play dates with the kids, attend all birthday parties, and spend holidays together. Richard wanted to do more with his life, and he applied to the Phoenix Police Department. His former wife, Ingrid, supported him in this decision. He loved the academy and studied hard. Even though Richard was always a very happy man and content with life, this change seemed to give him purpose, and he frequently stated this is something his family could be proud of him for doing. His then-wife and I also had our second sons around the same time. It was a perfect friendship, given both of our husbands were hard workers supporting us, and we were stay-at-home moms. We were the only people to ever babysit for each other, and I never had any hesitation when dropping my boys off for a weekend with Richard and Ingrid. Richard always kept the boys entertained, riding bikes, skateboarding, fishing, or even teaching them how to tend a garden. My boys love him like an uncle. After my third son was born, he ended up in the hospital for 2 weeks. Though I have a lot of family in the Valley, Richard and Ingrid were the only ones I knew I could call on to take care of my kids during this time that I could trust completely. Richard was an officer during this time, so he was busy when he was at work. But several times over the 2 week period, when I would call to speak to my sons, Ingrid would tell me he had taken the boys fishing or to the movies during his days off so that Ingrid could get a break. Unfortunately, their marriage was not to last, and Ingrid and myself's friendship abruptly ended. This is when my and Richard's friendship fully blossomed. Over the summers, we would all go camping and shooting. We planned many events together to make sure our boys kept their best friends since birth, even though he was now a single dad doing it on his own while working a very demanding job. He always put the kids first. Richard got lucky and married Maria, an amazing woman with 2 girls of her own. He raised those girls no different from his boys or my own. They were family and they came first. Richard has been my best friend, and now because of this tragedy, I no longer have him by my side. My kids lost not only an uncle, but their best friends as well. This event has broken many hearts. I am asking you to take into consideration the man I have known for 18 years and the character he has shown that I can only briefly describe in this letter as a compassionate, caring, loyal, and hardworking man. Wanting to be a better person in life for his family and himself by choosing his profession, Richard should be defined by the man he has been in his life, not by the single event. I have spoken to Richard on the phone, and I have gotten to visit him, and he has always expressed a deep regret for the events that led up to this. I know Richard will be a very productive member of society upon release. He will continue to piece his family back together and strive to financially support them regardless of the obstacles he will be facing. Our hearts have not yet begun healing, and and our prayers will never cease, and our faith in the system will never waver. Sincerely, Sarah Wilkinson, friend from Avondale. This is dated December 13, 2017. At this point, I would ask the warden to hear from the various friends and family members that have signed here today.
Okay, before we hear from the family members, we would like to give the board an opportunity to ask you or Mr. Christman any questions that they may have, and some of them may be answered by family members or others during the day. I take note that in phase one, we went over in detail a number of things, including the offense itself. Is there anything else you want to share with the board about the offense itself? Back in October of 2010, or the records from the first, from phase one hearing, just stands on its own. Is there anything else you or Mr. Christman would like to add?
The only thing I would like to add from the discussion that we had previously is, over the now year and a half that I've known Mr. Christman, whom I've never actually met in person, but we've spent hours talking on the phone over the past time of my representation, it is clear to me that his remorse is genuine, that he accepts responsibility, and as I mentioned earlier, that he has done so with much more grace than, frankly, any other defendant. He has conducted himself very honorably, and he takes responsibility and is deeply apologetic to the victims and their families.
Does she consider the offense itself as being an accident, or what? After these years, since 2010, how's it reflect in his mind? Was this an accident, or this was something that took place simply because he was on duty at that particular moment? What's his thoughts on that, ma'am?
We've had long conversations about his thoughts and feelings about the actual incident, and I have worked with Rich in order to process the entire situation. It is his belief that under the circumstances, as he saw them unfolding, that he had followed his training, that he had appropriately and properly followed the escalation and the use of force. It was his belief that what he did was necessary after the victim in this case continued to engage in extreme behavior. He felt he had no other choice to prevent the loss of his own life or serious injury. He deeply regrets that any of this unfolded. He deeply regrets the loss of life. However, he did believe that he was following the guidelines of his training and that he had absolutely no choice. That said, after the case resulted in a mistrial, he accepted a plea agreement. He agreed to plead guilty to this offense. This circumstance, this situation, is entirely different. This situation will never occur again. We all know Mr. Christman will never return to law enforcement. We all know he will never, ever be allowed to possess a gun again. This is not a situation that is capable of repetition. There's absolutely no way. It is my belief that Mr. Christman, having had the significant amount of time, has now begun to process it. He clearly is going to continue to need professional help and therapy to deal with not only the incident that led us here, but these years that he spent in custody. And he has committed to me and to his family that he's willing to do that, and that he will do whatever is necessary so that he can deal with the mental anguish that he is suffering, with the undoubtedly post-traumatic stress that he must suffer in order to move forward and to find a new career and to be successful.
Do you know how he feels about the fact that the other officer who was present, who saw things a little different than he did? Has he reflected on that at all?
He has reflected on that. And for a long time, it was his belief that the other officer had perhaps left Rich out to dry, that he was not where he could have been or where he should have been, and that perhaps the situation could have played out differently. That said, Mr. Chrisman holds no ill will. He understands that in the heat of the moment, officers and people, frankly, see things differently. They perceive risk differently. They had different vantage points. They had different experiences. He holds no ill will toward his former partner or, frankly, anyone else.
And you've already mentioned the plea agreement, which I think was signed on December 10, 2013. Why did he agree to that plea agreement if he was innocent? Is there any particular reason?
I don't believe it's that Rich maintained that he was quote-unquote innocent. He had been in custody for a long period of time at that point. He had sat through a lengthy trial, which had resulted in a jury that could not come to a conclusion. The trial itself was exceptionally difficult, given the testimony that was presented and given the presentation that the state made. Mr. Chrisman had been in lockdown for 23 hours a day throughout this dependency of the case. He was exhausted. He was transported to court early in the morning. He was not regularly eating. He was barely sleeping. The level of stress that he had been feeling during the trial is, frankly, impossible to imagine. In addition to the stress that he and his family had been going through while the case was pending. After the jury hung, Mr. Chrisman decided it was in his best interest to not put his family, and frankly the victim's family, through all of that again. And so when he was presented, and I believe I may be wrong about this, but I believe that the plea agreement was presented to him perhaps over the noon hour or something to that effect, and he was given a very short period of time to make a decision. Because often, when the state comes forward with a plea, it's the state's complete right to say, no, we're not going to offer you a plea. When, I believe it was Mr. Martinez, offered the plea agreement, Rich had a brief period of time to make a decision, and he made the decision that he believed was best for him and his family in order to put this all behind them.
I would just take note that, and I know this came out in our phase one hearing, that he, at the plea agreement itself, he did receive the minimum sentences with the agreement. The presumptive would have been 10.5 years. The maximum could have been as much as 20 years, but he did. I just have one other question that I hear the other board members, and I'm fast forward now because of a statement that you made, and I'm not quoting what you said, but my interpretation. You indicated that Mr. Chrisman would not be involved in law enforcement or the criminal justice system again in terms of professional employment. And I'm just wondering what is his release plans if the governor sees fit to grant him clemency.
This is something that we have talked about a lot. And when I first met Rich, he wasn't really able to even think about it. He was so bogged down in his circumstances and in his situation. So it quickly became one of our conversations that next time we talk, we need to hear more. You can start dreaming again, because he had shut down his ability to even think about the future. I know that his immediate plans are to reunite with his family and spend as much time with his children as possible. He also has a dear friend who is, I believe, a retired college professor, who has said that they would provide guidance to him and that they would help him find something that would make good use of his skills and that would allow him to manifest all those things that led him to become a police officer. He became a police officer because he cares about the community, because he cares about children, and he cares about women, and he cares about making this a safer and a better place to live. He's talked about the possibility of working with young people who are troubled. And so all of that is still something that he is going to have to work through a little bit. However, he knows that it's going to be a long road, and that until he heals himself and receives the counseling and the therapy that he needs to recover from this last 7 or 8 years, that until he does those things, he's not going to be in a great position. But over the last 6 months, there's a marked change in his ability to actually talk about the future. At first when I asked him, it was, I don't know. And now he's begun to dream again and to be able to refocus on his goals. So that is a bit of a work in progress. But the ultimate thing that he wants is, of course, to spend time with Maria, with his mom, and with his children.
Thank you. Now I'm going to yield to other board members for questions that they may have for you. Board members, any questions? Yes, Honorable Mr. Kiwanis.
Thank you, Mr. Board Chairman. Just a quick question, and that is, the incident happened in 2010, correct?
Correct.
How long has he been in custody in one form or another? It gets a little blurry in the Ames forms, like being held in jail during the trial, correct?
Correct.
And then his prison sentence. So how long is his total custody at this point?
Let me check one thing. He went into custody on September 13 of 2013.
Okay, I do have that data. The way it was described this morning, I thought, well, was there time prior to that? Because it's usually, you know, added up together through Ames. So right. It is 2013. It would seem that he has been incarcerated for about 4.25 years at this point.
I believe that's right.
Thank you. That's just my question.
Thank you, Honorable Mr. Kiwanis. Honorable Ms. Rittenhouse.
No,
no questions at this time. I'm going to let you decide to order that supporters will come. I'm not going to make that decision because I have a list of about 2 pages, but I am going to ask that supporters kind of limit that testimony before the board, but I'm going to leave it up to you.
Very good. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
We're going to begin with Officer Sexton.
Good morning, Officer, and would you state your name for the record, sir?
My name is Leon Sexton.
Thank you so very much, and welcome to the board this morning, sir.
Thank you, and it's an honor to speak before the board. Briefly, in my almost 20 years in law enforcement, which will be ending next Friday, I have never spoken on behalf of anyone convicted of a crime. I was also, prior to the event of 2010, I was Rich's supervisor. Now, the reason I'm in uniform today, I'm not representing the Phoenix Police Department. I'm at work, and I'm currently taking my lunch break, which is why I asked to go first so that I can return to my duties. When Rich worked for me, he was part of a phenomenal squad, but he was a person that I could count on 100% of the time. I cannot say that of every officer that's worked for me. They're human beings, and they all work at different levels, and frankly, at some different trust levels. Because you become a police officer doesn't change human nature. But Rich was one that I could absolutely count on when something needed to be done. Generally, it was already being done. In fact, there were times that I would have to rein Rich in because he was wanting to go in ways that his moral compass was, and I frankly agreed with him, yeah, that's be good things, but you know what? We have to kind of limit our involvement here. We have other agencies we can turn this over to, and we need to get back to our next call for service. There's somebody that needs a police officer. And yeah, I can see working with those kids. I can see, but I got to hold you back on this one. I'm sorry. In addition to being his supervisor and having that kind of level of trust and work with him, I'm also an ordained minister and a chaplain, was his official chaplain during his trial period. So I was visiting him regularly and then have maintained a letter contact with him. Without going into the kind of the privilege of the confessional and the working with a minister, I can tell you that the Rich that I knew prior to the arrest and the Rich that I knew afterwards as his faith-based and going where he was going, things that you've heard from his attorney, I'm going to echo it without repeating it because I also heard your instructions not to repeat those things, but they were the exact same things that I heard and have continued to hear. Like I said, I've never spoken on behalf of an arrestee before. I don't know that I will ever again. But in this particular case, knowing the man that I know, knowing the man that I knew before the arrest, knowing the man that I knew prior to the arrest and prior to the conviction, it is my absolute strongest belief that this is a person that would benefit the society in Arizona upon his release, and I would encourage that with all possibilities. Thank you.
Questions, board members? Thank you, and good luck in the future, sir.
Thank you.
Nice to hear from Rich's wife, Maria Crispin.
Good morning, ma'am, and would you state your name for the record?
My name is Maria Crispin.
And welcome to the board.
This morning, I am not going to be repetitive. I am not going to say something that is being said as many times. As a wife, and we have been married for a little bit over 6 years, dating for almost 10. Oh, God. That's a long time to know a guy, to know what his weak spots are, what his strongest things are. As we know, you never end knowing a person. The time that you spend with that person, you continue to learn and growing together. As older you get, that's the difference you see outside and the difference you learn from that person. My now husband, then a boyfriend, he was so respectful of his uniform. We will not see each other when he was wearing his uniform. Oh, for God forbid that I will say, hey, or text him at my lunchtime, what are you doing? It's like, work. That was it for hours. And then after he was off, then he was like, oh, I'm so sorry, I was working. You know, I don't like to use my work time for doing things that I am not allowed to. We were all young, new in a job, learning how to deal and cope with with people that we don't interact every day, all the time, many hours of the day. You can't have a day where you have an easy day. Each job has that. I'm working in a pediatrician office now, and couple weeks ago, at that office where I was, we see adults and kids patients. Right now, I'm focusing just kids. And the people that was in one office to the other one, it changes. The moods, the thoughts of the person who comes in that day is so different than when it comes. They can come the next morning and be a totally different person. My point at this is saying, when you are interacting in such a high-risk job where all you have to do is focus on what your job is, what your duty, your responsibility and the matter of your job is, all you have to do is you have two choices. Do it right, go back home. What did you do? When you have to deal with that, you do it right, but you also go back home. My husband did. We're being together, not in the same spot. We have grown together. We have think. His attorney was saying up to a few months back, every time I ask him, well, what do you want to do? He's like, I don't know. Because I have at least a few years before I can go back home. But I'm like, but what do you want to do? What's your plan? What are you thinking? What, I don't know. In the last few months, his path haven't changed. And I might have a little bit with that because I'm like, okay, well, you are a 44-year-old. You lost your job, your dream, your career. For him, it was a career. But you haven't lost your life. You are barely in the middle of your life. And we will go out to finish that line. We have that. We never had the chance to have a honeymoon. Financial or circumstantial was what happened. Because we got married in the middle of the three-year period we were going to court once a month at least. And to be told, you have court date, this date. And then the next 8 hours, oh no, sorry, you know what? One part cannot make it. Oops, my mistake. We'll let you know when you can go back. So it was very stressful. So a lot of nights that he won't sleep. I can't count with one hand the nights that he will wake up, breaking in sweat, screaming, punching. I am very fortunate that sleeping next to him, I never pick up punch. But I can tell you it was very close. It was not that he was aggressive, but he was just in this such a stress with what had happened and continued to happen through all those months and 3 years during the trial that had made that make a change. He was scared. He was afraid. He wake up every morning, he will say, because I will tell him what happened during the night, and I will sit down next to him, watch him sleep. He went to a behavioral institution for a few days, and he was prescribed medication to help him to relax and to try to cope with what happened after that day, to try to understand and put in his brain. I do truly believe it wasn't his fault. It is not his fault. You ask why he did accept the plea deal. My husband was painted. He has two pictures. You go to jail for up to 7 years, or you go to jail for maybe 25. He has 13, 11, 6, and my daughter was 16 years old at that time. Did you leave four children for 7 years, or you leave those children for 25? He asked me, what do you want me to do? I take a step back and say, it's your life, your choice. Don't take me as your wife, as your partner, as your... Don't even count on me in this decision. This is you. What do you want to do? How do you want to do it? I let him have that decision on his own. Nothing else was based, but that decision based on, but his kids. And then me. He had, and I have always told him, always make the decisions based for his kids. His kids have always been what is the matters for him. He loves me. I have no doubt of that. He would do whatever, anything for me. And I would do the same for him. This day, all the years behind me, I have no regrets of supporting and keeping this man back. Because I know who he is. I know what he does. I know what he can do in the future. I haven't even painted. I have even asked him if we can go to Hawaii. That's my child dream. I have always dreamed to go to Hawaii. I am from a different country. And Hawaii pictures are the dream of any person. And in a country where you have to work your whole life to have a vacation to a water park next to your house is the best that can happen to you. Here, now, I want to go further, but I want to go different, big. I know Hawaii, for a lot of people, is not big the deal, but when you have lost so many years in your life, all you want to do is take the time to make that count, everything and anything. We do have plans. We want to make those plans true. And I am going to make him go to school. If he like it or not, I'm going to. He has to. Not for anyone else, but for himself. He is the kind of person who does deserve better than what he has gone through this last few years. He does deserve it. He's a hard worker, a good father, an amazing husband. Even not being together, we have shared and deal with things. And now we do understand better each other. We will. We do. He does deserve an opportunity to come back to his house. I fully believe that you are, don't listen to me as a wife. Listen to me as a person who just knows that this guy won't do anything wrong if he comes back to his wife. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. And board members, any questions? I don't see any questions from board members. Thank you so very much.
Next, I would ask the board to hear from Casey Gilmore. Hi, I'm Cassandra Gilmore. I'm Richard Christman's sister.
Welcome to the board.
I'm a bit of a rambler, especially when I'm nervous and a little stressed out, so I'm going to read my letter directly.
Just relax. Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
So, in March of 1999, U.S. Police Officer Mark Atkinson died in the line of duty. There was a candlelight vigil and fundraisers to help his family. I lived in Camp Verde, Arizona, and had been visiting my brother at this time. We were watching the news regarding the officer's death and the tremendous outpouring of support from the community. I made a comment along the lines of, why are they making such a big deal? He's just a guy who died. At that time, my opinion of police officers was they were the guys that gave me speeding tickets. So my brother turned to me and he said, he was a man that put his life on the line every day to help people. He was a hero and deserves to have everyone make a big deal of his life. My brother was basically scolding me, but I didn't really understand at the time because I lived in a small town. Cops didn't die in the line of duty. I based my opinion on whether or not they gave me that speeding ticket that day. I didn't think about how many times they put their lives on the line for people. I didn't know it at the time, but my brother was already considering becoming a police officer. I never would have guessed this as a path for him. We did not have any police officers in our family, really. We grew up pretty poor, just trying to get by day by day. He was always a protective person. He watched over me as a teenager and helped me to learn and make good choices, but I still never pictured him as a cop. A few months later, I came to visit him again, and he had cut his hair extremely short. Completely out of character for him. We were standing in his yard and I asked him why he cut his hair like that. He said, you can't tell anyone, but I'm applying to be a police officer. I was shocked, excited, and proud. He looked so enthusiastic that this was obvious this would be a passion for him. When my brother graduated from the police academy, I could not have been prouder. To see him succeeding at such a high standard profession was beautiful. My whole family was there. We celebrated and had dinner after graduation, taking pictures, laughing, and smiling. None of us were thinking about the many possible outcomes this choice could have. My brother became a police officer because he wanted to be a hero. He liked protecting people that couldn't protect themselves, and he wanted to make a difference in people's lives. He did it for all the right reasons. At that time, none of us would have believed that 16 years later we would be applying to the Board of Clemency and begging for his release from prison.
If you ask my brother today if he would have changed his path had he known this is where it would lead, I believe he would say no, because regardless of all the lost time he's had from his family, regardless of all the pain and stress this has put on all of us, there were probably hundreds of people he saved or helped in some way. In 10 years, let me skip that because it's been repeated. I can't tell you how many times Richard has helped me in my life, whether it be with financial or emotional support. His stories of being a Phoenix police officer were sometimes horrifying and other times beautiful. I loved hearing the success stories when he was able to go back and check on that teenager that had broken the law and help him to make better choices and learn to be better. Or the family who was fighting and struggling, and he was able to provide resources for them to help their family. My brother has been incarcerated. It wasn't just about busting bad guys, but also about helping people improve their lives. My brother's been incarcerated for just over 4 years now for a tragedy that we all wish hadn't happened. His wife is one of the most amazing women I've ever had the pleasure of knowing. She does everything she can to help and support him. Many officers that were and part of my brother's family have continued to assist with financial and emotional support for my brother and our family. He has missed so much of life this past 4 years. His ex-wife immediately took custody of his two sons and moved across the country after he was incarcerated. He has seen the boys one time since then because that's not the only time that we could manage to get them out there for him. My niece, Angie, she's becoming a teenager, and I know this through social media because, like I said, I live in another town. But he really needs to be here for her now. He's a kind man. He is patient. Even when the kids would break something or make bad decisions, he would talk to them and help them understand how to make better choices. He deserves to be home with us now. It's time for us all to move away from this and put this tragedy behind us. So I beg you to please recommend his clemency.
Thank you so very much. Any questions, board members? No questions. Thank you, ma'am.
Next, I would ask the board to hear from Bobby and Crystal.
Good morning, sir, and would you state your name for the record?
My name is Robert William Christman. I am Richard's brother. Earlier there was a question that was asked about my brother's plans when he gets out of prison. And I thought it was kind of ironic because I had just had that conversation with him Monday on the telephone. And he had actually mentioned to me furthering his education. He wanted to go back to college. He wanted to get a degree. And in the middle of that discussion, before we could come to a complete understanding on how and when and where he was going to do this, the phone automation system said, "Thank you, have a nice day, click." And that's been my communication with my brother for the past 4 years. Pretty much telephone conversation. I get 15 minutes a week. And there's no warnings on those telephone calls. When your 15 minutes is up, you can be in mid and click. He became a police officer because he wanted to make his mark. He wanted to do something positive for the world. He wanted to help people. He wanted to leave something. He wanted to leave something behind that would be remembered. Prior to becoming a police officer, he had already done so. He did it with us. And the genuine person that he grew up to be, he left something behind for us. For the rest of the world, for the state of Arizona. Everybody that goes to a football game in Chase Field and they watch that rooftop open before becoming a police officer, my brother fabricated the trusses on that roof. He has skills, he has talent, and he has the means to become, to re-become a productive member of society. The only thing that's stopping him right now from doing so is his location. Mm-hmm. do you think that you'd consider this? Give him a chance. Write you down. He's never let us. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Honorable Ms. Rittenhouse.
Mr. Crisman, are you, what's the order in the family? Are you, your siblings?
Are you looking to degrade?
No, I, no, please, no.
Because I am the oldest.
Oh, okay, all right. And then your sister, you just spoke?
I actually, my little brother and then my sister. And then I also have two other sisters.
Okay, so there are five of you all together. Okay, all right, thank you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Any further questions? Okay. Thank you so very much, sir. Mr. Richmond, Crisman, we do hear a great deal of noise. Is there some way that you can see if it's possible to tone it down, sir?
The noise, I can try. I didn't realize you guys were able to hear any noise.
Well, if you can, we would appreciate it. If not, we do understand, sir.
Yes, it's just I'm in an office. I'm in a sergeant's office on the phone here. So if he's moving around doing his daily business, I.
Okay, sir. Thank you, sir.
Also, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
Occasionally, the speaker's voices are cutting out. I hear you loud and clear when you're speaking, but occasionally the speakers, their voices are cutting in and out, just so we're aware.
Thank you. And I'm going to ask all speakers, speak loud. I think if you speak loud and direct into that mic, he can hear you. So please speak loud. Like I do, I just talk loud, so please, but please go ahead, attorney.
Yes, sir. Next, I'd like to hear from Kathy Moe.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And what do you want, what's your name, please, ma'am?
Kathy Moe.
And welcome to the board. And what do you want to tell the board?
Okay, I too wrote because I get lost.
And speak loud directly into that mic so that Ms. Crisman can hear you.
Okay. Richard is my second cousin. I grew up with his mom. We were taught the same values of honesty, integrity, and how precious life is. For quite a while, I corresponded with Rich after he was incarcerated. I really felt he needed somebody to supply hope. I'm sure other people wrote to him too, but that was the burden that I felt, was he needed hope. I found out that he wasn't able to have any TV or radio or even a CD player, and the biggest hope that I get is through God. And I really felt that there were times when God would move a song for me to write out the words and the lyrics to for him that would bring hope to him. He would write back and say, I sure wish I could hear that song. And one day, oh, Rich. but through that time, we talked a lot about family, about aunts and uncles and people that we loved and people that we've lost and all those different things. He has a very good sense of humor, but I could tell through the writing that he was hurting a lot too. I know that he's a funny guy. My sister worked with him in a nursing home in Camp Verde. She worked in the kitchen, and he worked with her. And she used to tell me about his sense of humor and how all the people that they fed and everything loved him. So I'm really looking forward to seeing the day when that comes back, when he really has that good sense of humor again and all of this is put behind him. I'm not looking at my notes, so then I'm lost. In the December of 2016, I broke my arm, on my dominant arm. I broke my humerus bone, and I wasn't able to write him for quite some time. My hand didn't work. And after coming in here to the last meeting, you know, I really realized how much I missed writing to Rich, and recently sent a letter to him. I'm really happy to hear things are going better for him, that he's able to study and do different things like that. But I really hope and pray that you guys make this decision to pass this on to the governor, because he's been through a lot. And I'm not a crier, and I'm on the verge. So I really think he's, you know, he's worked hard all his life. Whatever he does with his whole heart. And I would hate to see a time in my own life where I needed a police officer and they had to sit there and wait if I have to bring my gun out. Am I going to be tried for murder? To me, I would rather, you know, be right there with who, whatever the situation was, trying to talk the person down from making a poor decision to bring it to that. But we don't know what goes through a person's mind. I just know that he was doing his job that day. He made the decision he felt he had to make. And if I made the same call I heard was made that day, I would hope that someone would come and defend me if it came to it, or defend themselves if it came to that. And thank you for your time and for helping.
Thank you, ma'am. Questions? Thank you so very much.
Next, I've asked the board to hear from Stephen Crystal.
Please state your name, sir.
Stephen Elvin Crispin.
And what do you want to tell the board, sir?
I am the first cousin to Richard. Me and my brothers, my mother has had four boys, and at the time where we spent a lot of time with Richard and his brother, we were a handful, needless to say. Richard was the youngest of all of us at that time, which there was five of us boys, and I could remember quite often that he was the fun sucker, if you'd like to call it that, when every time us older boys were up to probably no good, at least in his mind, he definitely made it a point to point that out to my mother as well as his mother. Looking back, I can see that he was more concerned about us getting in trouble than having fun, I guess, in our mind. Around Christmas of 2000, it was kind of a unique moment because I was at my maternal grandmother's house, which Richard was there as well with his, I believe, his fiance. They were getting ready to get married. And he expressed to me that he was getting ready to join the police academy. And I had an overwhelming feeling of pride that there was going to be a Christian out there not only protecting me and my family, but protecting those around me. And what life does to a lot of us, he had his new family, I had my new family. We went in one direction, he went in another direction. Kind of kept tabs or past the academy. Just what life does to a lot of us, we kind of get separated from some of our family members, and you know, even though they're still family, we still care for them. You know, we just don't really see each other that often. And the same thing with life gives us a lot. What brings us together is tragedies. And when this tragedy happened, you know, we all try to make a point to reconnect with one another. At that time, Richard did have a lot of time because he was no longer employed. You know, prior to the trial, he was doing everything that he could to be able to be a support to his family. He got a job being a landscaper. Came to me because I was worked for a general contractor, asking me, "Hey, is there anything I can do to be a subcontractor for any jobs that you get on?" As a matter of fact, I used him a couple times, and one time that I did use him, he had brought his two boys, which was a very rare time for him to have his boys, and actually was sitting and teaching them a little bit of work ethic, along with Maria. I think they were really trying to get their life in order, even though it was so chaotic. Him, there was a couple times where we had just got together and just kind of hung out and you know, kind of curious, I'm sure, of all of us were, and asked questions about the situation, and he says, "You know, I really can't talk about that." And really, you said basically because I, you know, it's an ongoing ongoing and whatnot. I just can't really talk about that. He really honored that. I do know that he lamented over the tragedy that happened. I know he was contrite. Never bitter, never prideful. He was always humble over the whole situation. He never talked ill will of nobody. Not the gentleman that he assisted on that day, not the family that went through this tragedy. He honored his job. He honored his family. And I hope that you will consider going to the governor and allowing the governor to make a decision for him to be home again. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Questions? No questions. Thank you.
Next, I would ask the board to hear from Ron Herber.
Good morning, board members.
Good morning, sir.
It's nice to see you again.
And what is your name, sir?
My name is Ronald Kevern, K-E-V-E-R-N.
Welcome to the board.
Thank you.
What do you want to share with the board?
I'm soon to be 85 years old, and I have a bucket list. One of my bucket list items is I want to be there for Richard Christman. I'm a former college professor. I spent 25 years working with people and choosing careers and deciding what they want to do with the rest of their lives. Richard and I have spent hours on the phone, often cut off in those 15 minutes in the middle of a discussion. We've discussed and looked long. I'm very willing to spend hours with him when he comes home, working on his career and his plans for the future. He has a wonderful family. He's a professional guy. I have found him probably one of the most exciting folks that I've worked with. I've worked with many prisoners in Michigan and have had success with every one of them. I'm honored to be part of Richard's life. I'm excited to be part of his future. I would like my bucket list to be completed, but I am 85 years old. So I'm looking for, as soon as possible, let's bring him home. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Questions?
Yes.
Honorable Mr. Kornis.
Just a quick thing, sir, and I recognize that this isn't necessarily about the hearing, but I just lost my college professor mentor this year. He died at 88, and I do want to thank you for the sort of mentorship you give. I just think it's so important.
Thank you very much.
So I appreciate that, sir. Thank you.
I appreciate your comments.
Thank you.
Next, we will have Mark King Hannon. He's in part of the overflow.
Okay. Good morning, sir. Would you state your name for the record?
My name is Mark King Cannon.
Welcome to the board.
Thank you very much for having me. Put these down so I can actually read what I've written. You've already received all the information you need. I'm not going to stand up here and repeat everything. I've known Rich for 16 years. 18, I've been on the department. I've known him most of my career. He was my partner. He's my friend. When I met Rich, and when I was fortunate enough to be able to ride with him and be with him for 10-hour shifts day after day, putting my life in his and his life in mine, you get to know somebody. Three words that you see every day when you're at the academy: honor, pride, and integrity. All three words that Rich has always lived his life by. As do I. He has passed that on every Monday when I speak to him. The honor is still there. The pride is still there. the integrity is still there. When Ryan wavers, and Ed wavered early on, he kept me focused. When the incident occurred on October 5th, 2007, a lot of us showed up to work the next day, flabbergasted. It is what it is. Rich kept us focused. Three things that I know Rich lives his life by, and I always have. Even when I got distracted, he kept me there. It was God, family, and country. He does not take anything else in that order. If you're fortunate enough to be his friend, it's just a blessing. I'm very fortunate to have been able to do that, been able to be his friend. Rich was a hard worker then, daily. I'm sure he's a hard worker now. The description he gives me of the job he does now for 13, 16 long hour days, he takes pride in it. That is the same individual, that's the same work ethic that you're going to get when he gets out here. When he gets out, he will be working. He has a long line of family, friends, and one of the strongest women I've ever met, in Maria. I like to call her my little firecracker. We joke about that every Monday because there's no lazy bone in Rich's body, but God forbid there ever was, she would not allow it. I can tell you that now. That aside, Rich is who Rich has always been. Rich is who Rich will always be. Now, God has put him on a path. He's not going to stray from that. Never has. I ask that you take everything into consideration that you've heard from day one until now to the end of this. And realize the hard-working individual that all of us have seen out on the street or the family has seen throughout the years is the same individual you're going to get by relation. I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Questions? I see no questions. Thank you, sir.
We're now moving on to Frank Marino.
Good morning, sir, and what is your name?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the board. Thank you for allowing me to speak. My name is Officer Franklin Marino, M-A-R-I-N-O. I'm a 23-year veteran of the Phoenix Police Department. I currently serve as the Secretary of the Phoenix Law Enforcement Association, PLEA, which collectively represents approximately 2,400 rank-and-file Phoenix police officers and detectives. PLEA represented Richard Crisman the day of his incident, and we continue to represent him throughout the aftermath of the trial, because we believe that what happened that day, it was a scope and course of duty incident. Rich didn't go out there. He wasn't a rogue cop who went out there on the rails with intent to hurt somebody. It was a tragic incident. It was tragic for everyone involved. The family, the Rodriguez family, but also the Crisman family. Rich has been through a lot, but he accepted what he did. He's put in his time. He's done his time. We believe that when he's released, he will once again be a productive member of society. We've heard it from his family. We've heard it from his friends. We've seen it ourselves. So we would request that the board grant clemency on an early release. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Questions? I see no questions from board members. Thank you so very much, sir.
We're moving now to Joe Clure.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joe Clore. I'm a retired Phoenix police officer of 34 years. I've been retired a couple years now. I've known Rich for about 10 years. I find Rich to be an extremely honorable individual, a man of integrity, a man of great character. it is very tragic what happened. But I will tell you, knowing the Rich Chrisman that I do, I have no qualms with having Rich around my family. I would ask him to watch my grandkids. Rich is a good, honest, kind, caring individual. I was at the time the association president when this event happened. So we're here in a unique situation, and we are actually part of the justice system. And we respect that justice system. Although far from perfect, one has to respect the judgments that come from the court, from the juries. And we do that, and we accept that. With regard to your job, you have a very important and difficult task ahead of you. You have to decide Rich's fate based upon the consideration of justice and the protection of the community going forward. I will tell you that in looking at that justice, it's not only, as it certainly should be from the perspective of the victims, but also the perspective of the incarcerated, of the arrestee, of the person that we're here today. And I will tell you that Richard has served his time. He has served a lot of time. I have a couple of nephews who are in prison for some pretty serious things, so I'm very familiar with the system. The family is allowed to go down there every week and visit, take them food, put money on their books, interact with them. It's not the best of circumstances, obviously, but it's permitted because they're general custody inmates. This event was a course of scope of employment that Rich was involved in, and because of that fact alone and that sole fact alone, his service of time is very, very different than what my nephews are experiencing and my family. And I would ask that you look at that when you look at the time. He's actually, in my opinion, basically serving dog years because of the circumstances, because of the uniqueness of this case. So I would ask that you look at that. I think Rich has had a wonderful attitude about all of this. Been very difficult, but I think it's amazing to me as just an individual, as a person, that there is no bitterness, there is no hate, there is no resentment. It's amazing. That's the kind of person that Rich is. And like I say, as regard to his likelihood to reoffend, my zero opportunity for that to happen. I would ask that you look at the bulk of Rich's life and his work product and what he has accomplished and the character that he has exhibited. I think you would readily find that the likelihood of reoffending is virtually nil. And I look forward to seeing Rich again. It's been a long time. And I would ask that you grant him clemency and allow this to be over. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. And how many more do you have, attorney?
I have two more.
Okay, please go ahead. Thank you, ma'am.
Next, I'd like you to hear from Rich's mother, Nancy Center.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Good morning, then. What is your name again, ma'am?
My name is Nancy Spinner. I'm Richard's mom.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
First of all, I want to thank everybody out there who has spoke in behalf of my son and about my son, because everything they've said is true. This child, well, to me, he's a child. From the time he was very small, everything he done was for other people. The boys, Stephen, Aaron, Brian, Bobby, all the Christmas boys, if they wanted a toy that Richard had, he would give it to them to see him, make them happy. That's the way he was from the time he was little, and that's the way he is today, this same man. If somebody needs something from him, he's willing to give it. He co-signed a loan for my daughter when her husband was overseas because she needed a car. My daughter had no job. He didn't know she was going to get paid, but she needed a car. Richard had the ability. He got her a car. When the day of the incident, my son got up like he would every day. Smile on his face, thanking God to be alive. Went to work. He was on his way back and somebody called for help. Another officer called for help. He answered that call because that's the way he is. He went to help that other officer. He did not go to harm anybody. That was the last thing on his mind. That took the light out of my son's eyes for a long time. To have to do what he done, it was hard for him to get over it. He did have to go for psychiatric care. He was on medication. Of course, you've all heard that. But it's not something he would do. You know, he did not want to do that. That was the last thing in his mind that day. I'm asking you to set him free, to come back, to support his family. He's got a teenage daughter that is the light of his eyes. She's going through the hardest part of her life without her dad. And she only had her dad for a year or two before he was taken away. Maria has been there with him from day one, never left his side. Richard wants to come home and work and support his family. I'm sorry, I'm repeating everything and I apologize. I just want to tell you again that my son is a very hard worker. He loves people. He's not, would not harm his life. I'm asking you to please bring him back to his family. My husband and I are getting old. We'd like to have him home with us soon. Just for a little while, you know. My sister, my daughter, my son, my daughter-in-law, and my grandchildren need him. Need him. Need their dad. Okay? I thank you for your time, and again, I thank everybody out there for their information about my son.
Thank you, ma'am. Questions?
Thank you. And I just spoke there, so now it's two more.
There's two more, okay.
Hello, my name is Ida Alfier. I'm Richard's second cousin. I just want to tell you about this man. In 2004, my nephew was killed in Iraq. And at the time, it was a very tragic event, very, hard to deal with. But Officer Chrisman, he came to this funeral, represented the Phoenix Police Department in a very respectful way. He took the time off his day and made sure that my sister had everything she needed, whatever she needed and everything. And just, I want to know that's his character. And also, my brother, when this incident happened, my brother asked me, why didn't he just say he was sorry? Why didn't he just turn around and say, I'm sorry? And I tried to explain this to my brother, that when you say you're sorry, you are admitting guilt. I believe in my heart, Richard felt he did nothing wrong other than do his job that day in the line of duty. It was his responsibility to take care of the situation he did, and it's an unfortunate event. But again, he felt in his heart that what he did was had to be done, and he did his job. And I'm asking, please, that he's done a lot of time now, and it's time really to bring him home to his family and let this man go on, living and be a productive member of society again. And I thank you very much for listening to me. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? No questions. Thank you.
And I believe we're going to close with AJ Bubba.
Chairman, members of the board.
Good morning, sir.
My name is Albert Buffa. I've been working for the City of Phoenix as a police officer for over 18 years. Also a former partner of Richard Chrisman as well. Back in the times when I worked with him, which was just days before this incident had occurred, the South Mountain Precinct, where we worked, is known as the most violent precinct in the city. We had a different way, I shouldn't say way, we had to have a different means than, say, a different area that was mostly brought up with wealth in just a completely different atmosphere. Often training, when you're in 400, the South Mountain Precinct, though it's not on the outlines that they train from, the instructors would always say, it's better to be judged by 12 than to be carried by 6. The reason being is because down there we were targets. People hated us. They would come after us because of the uniform that we wear. Working with Rich, day in, day out, multiple hours a day. As a matter of fact, I spent more time with him than he did with his wife. I was known as his second wife to our group of friends. I never saw his character waver, his integrity, his pride. I watched him, he watched me, we worked hand in hand. He never made a bad decision that I could see. I trusted him with my life as he trusted me with his. You only get to hear about officers when bad things come out in situations like this. But what you don't get to see, and what never, there's no number that you can judge upon, is the amount of lives that you have impacted and saved. Just by taking someone off the street, you potentially could have saved someone else's life, because that person, if you were allowed to continue, especially a violent person, continuing on a rampage, could have hurt someone else. But we can't put a number on it. But that's what we do. We go out there and we do that every day. I've known other officers. As like any other job, you have bad seeds. You have people that don't carry the ethical line that you would like to carry yourself. There's been officers that I know that have been arrested or fired for reasons. I don't go up and speak for them. I don't continue my relationships with them. But this case is completely different. We have to make decisions on a split second notice, which then you have years afterwards for people to comb through with a fine-tooth comb to figure out if what we did was right or wrong. After the incident, those closest to Rich had some mental holdback sometimes about going out there, wondering what's going to happen to us, you know, if we were in a big fight. If Rich, I know I'm more than just me, but all I'm going to speak for is me, is when I'd come to him and I would say these things, he would encourage me to not back away. Don't not do this job. Because I actually thought about that. I thought about my place. Should I stay here or should I go? He looked at me and he said, AJ, you're a great officer. Don't you dare leave. Don't you dare back down. You go out there and you serve those citizens. After what he had been through, and he's telling me this, and I know I'm not the only one. I know I'm not the only one. Amazing. Volumes for his character. We have conversations on a frequent basis, at least once a week usually, and we talk every day, and it started before all this started. Maybe he didn't voice it with the others about what he's going to do when he gets out. Education is huge on his list. He knows he needs to support his family, but education is huge on his list. Not to mention, he has everyone here and hundreds of more colleagues along with his family to help support him and guide him to make sure that he's successful. I ask that you send this file with clemency to the governor so that he can make his decision. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. Questions? None. Thank you so very much.
Wait a minute. I do have one question.
We do have a question.
It's just a question that I haven't asked along the way. I recognize he's on the phone. I'm asking a third party. But Was Mr. Crisman, was South Mountain the only precinct he served in?
South Mountain Precinct has one area that you can go to that's not like South Mountain as far as geography goes, which is Ahwatukee. I think that he served up there as a school resource officer for a little bit before he came back to a patrol squad. But as far as I know, that's all I know that he worked on.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Any follow-up questions? Thank you, sir.
I believe that concludes the friends and family and colleagues that wanted to address the board.
Okay. Thank you so very much, and you will have an opportunity to sum up in closing. So now, at this time, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to ask that everybody please cooperate. I'm going to call for a 5-minute recess. Those of the victims who wish to leave the room, please go out that door. Those who are supporters who wish to leave the room, go out this door. If you don't want to take the 5-minute recess, you're welcome to stay in this room. So the board is taking a 5-minute recess.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. President, we are on a 5-minute recess. If you need to use the facilities or something, we should be back in about 5 minutes, sir.
Okay.
They couldn't hear the voice.
I'm going to shut it down and see what will happen. You don't need this one. So.
That you read into the record, just maybe up, just for the record. Is all your people in yet?
Yes, they are.
Okay. Then we will call the board back to order. The recess is over. And following the outline that I provided up front, at this time we will have statements, testimony coming from the victim side. I don't know whether the county attorney's office wished to be first or whether other victims, but I'm going to let him make that decision for us. So please come forward, sir.
Good morning.
Wait 1 second. Mr. Chrisman, are you back?
Yes, sir.
Okay, just want to make sure. Thank you.
Good morning. The way that the state will proceed is that I will ask Elvira Fernandez to make a statement. And she is the mother of, I'm going to call him Forgotten One, because certainly nobody has mentioned his name here. If we had gone through this hearing and the other one, we wouldn't even know this person's name, because this has been all about another individual, but we can't forget that there's another side to this. So Elvira Fernandez will tell you what this has done to her, and hopefully she will give you the name of this person that, as I said, is a forgotten man.
Good morning, ma'am.
Good morning.
And would you state your name for the record?
My name is Elvira Fernandez.
And welcome to the board.
Thank you. I'm going to talk a little bit about my son, Gabriel Rodriguez. First, I want to say something real quick. In our country, our motto is...
Could you speak into the mic? Just thank you.
In our country, our motto is, thou shalt not kill. Because thou shalt be prosecuted. In any country, it's called murder. My son Daniel has empathy, sacrifice, and all, and he will carry a judge wherever he lays. This was a senseless killing of my boy and his dog, Jeremy. I'm going to talk a little bit of how the less than 2 minutes when Richard Christman approached me, he asked me a question, and the first thing he said back to me was, speak English, I don't understand what you're saying. I asked him, I am speaking English. What language do you speak? And he said, you're not speaking my language. But I understand what I said to him. To live in this country, we live here, we don't look for your people. But that was the end of that conversation. And you know, this is a village in the house. And I said to her, he asked me, is your son home? I said, yes, he's sleeping. He goes to school at night. He asked me, I was. He said, he probably went back, doesn't understand English. I told him, I said that to you before, we're from this country, we're from this land, we're the people. And he said, no. And he ran to the house where his son was, opened the door, ran in, and the first thing he did is my son was approaching on the highway. We gave him a contusion with his pistol on his right to knock him down to the ground. And then an officer right here tried to help them get up because he was a little unconscious. Then the pepper spray officer right here and Daniel at the same time. So the officer had to leave to get some air because it was just really hard for him. At that point, Daniel picked up his shirt to wipe his eyes, and Officer Christian at that time, he had his shirt on. He did not have a shirt, so it was visible that he did not have a ring on him. And he touched him on his bare skin. Officer over here tried to run back in to draw him out down the gun. At that time, the officer got his gun and shot Daniel's dog. His name is Junior. He was a 4-month-old pup. He did not even have his cane on, according to them. To the autopsy, which is how they were able to get by him. And so he shot him in the back while Jim going towards the hallway, and he could have seen the dog was coming from the left, so he crawled to Daniel, weeping. And Daniel, the officer got his gun again and shot Jim in the ear. And that's when I could hear Daniel screaming only 3 times. Yeah, the house trembled. It was really dark outside of the doors, 12:30, because it was the worst one that Arizona has ever seen on that day. And you could hear the thunder at the same time, you could hear them screaming. I tried to run over there, screaming, and shoot my sons in the house. And when we heard the next 2 shots, I think it was supposed to be a little front of that son. So I tried to run over there. That moment, I moved it to the house and on the side. When I got there, I opened the door for the library and I never saw off the plan of the door again. I opened the door and got this floor and pushed it up the foot. At that moment, Officer Christman walked out with his hands up in the air. And I thought, what happened? So my sister-in-law read this report from me. Before he shot Daniel, what he did was, Daniel screamed, why are you killing my son? Why are you killing my son? Why are you killing my son? That's when he pointed the gun towards Daniel, which was arm length from the gun to Daniel, as far from Daniel, like I said. And shot him. The first shot did not kill my son, but the second one did. If he broke the bullet, just looking for him. Daniel stood with his hands up in the air, helpless, pleading, whoa, but he still shot him. Officer McGee was standing at the door because they were already going out. He decided not to look because he knew that Christmas was going to execute his son. So he did not, look at that. But he was right there next to Daniel. When I tried to walk in there, I didn't see Grandma on my slide, and I do not see a lot better, but I don't think I saw his cushion off now with his hands up. And all of a sudden, I tried to open the door because it felt like the living room looked like there was a lot of disorder. The table was broken, and the coffee table was a glass table. And the next thing I was by had been kind of fallen. And I tried to go in, and I had not gone in, I just was watching from the opening. And when I tried to open the door, because I heard a little noise in the dining room, I thought, well, maybe there's somebody somewhere. And suddenly a hand came out and pushed me out and locked the door. I knew that there was an Officer Krishna. And I stood there until I didn't let anybody open the door until I saw Brandy. Cameron trusted Richard Krishna. He was there to protect him, not to kill him. And the senseless killing that he did to my son is something that I remember every day he goes to my mind of what happened to him. He must have been so scared, so helpless that moment. He had 3 or 5 seconds apart from that killing. He has never publicly said, I'm sorry for killing his son, mother. To this day, it's the first time you hear from people saying that they're yet not to hear from him. You know, Richard Krishna will come out in a few more years. He will see his children. He will see his mother again. But I will never see my son. I've been to counseling every therapy. I've been to psychiatrists for all these years because it really hurts. All these tears that put themselves in my hands, just bringing them back. Just over them. Just pause my chin. I'm praying that you will make the right decision for my son. Thank you for this much. Appreciate that.
Thank you so very much. Board members, any questions?
Yes.
Honorable Mr. Kiwanis.
I ask this with respect. Who called the police that day?
I did.
Why did you call?
He was being disrespectful. He was upset with his dad. He was on vacation. He was from school at night. He was upset. So he disrespected me. I was really hurt because he's never done that to me. So I went out and my neighbor told me, what's the matter? It's terrible. So I said that I called him just to scare him, but she said, you should. Sure, she said, I did my mind on her. And so I said, I don't think so, I can handle it, but she dialed the number for me and I called him. And I told him, whatever there is, there's nothing bad, I can handle it. So I'm going to go check it. But Richard Krishna ran into the house to kill my son.
I have one follow-up question. When Officer Krishna had words with you about not understanding your English and made the comment that the victim was a wetback, did Officer Kihil hear that?
Yes, he did. He told him to calm down.
Thank you. I have no further questions, but thank you.
Thank you. Honorable Ms. Rittenhouse.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ma'am, had you ever called the police before for when your son acted up? Or?
One time, because he had some friends and I didn't like him. But yeah,
so one time before this?
2 years before the was.
All right, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so very much, ma'am. Thank you.
For my part of the presentation,
just Juan, take your name again, just for the record.
Juan Martinez on behalf of the Maricopa County Attorney's Office. For
thank you, sir.
For my part of the presentation, I want to talk about Richard Krishna a bit more. Perhaps I should call him Saint Richard Krishna, because as the way he's been described to you, he's the individual who would give up his toys. He's the individual that would do backup.
He's the individual that would do work for people, would co-sign loans, would do all of these wonderful things for them. He was such, according to them, such a saint. But one of the things that we need to do is when you have a one-sided presentation like that, because the previous hearing was to determine whether or not the sentence was excessive, not to determine about what actually happened. But in this case, what actually happened is that two officers responded, Sergio Virgil and Richard Chrisman. And the other officer didn't fire, didn't do anything. But as you heard, when Chrisman arrived, don't know what was going through his mind, but we do know that he had a chip on his shoulder. It was more than a chip on his shoulder. It appears to be a racist chip on his shoulder when he spoke to the mother and said whatever it was that she told you that he said. That doesn't sound like the officer that is there to carry out his duty that has been described, the saint that has been described to you. That sounds more like a rogue police officer who's derelict in his duties. And so this officer who, given what we've heard from somebody that was there, these other individuals weren't there, they don't know what happened, who is being derelict, who is using what is, under anybody's definition, a racist or a bigoted term, decides he's going to investigate this. And when he goes in there, you can tell, and I mention this because you now know that he has this attitude. As wide as that door that he walked in, or as forceful as that gun that he had struck to his hip, walked on in there, and what the evidence showed at the trial was that there were two officers. One who said that objectively, with all due respect to what the Honorable Warren Granville wrote, he disagreed with him, and he was there. The judge wasn't there. This other officer, Sergio Virgil, was there. He said there was no danger ever posed by this individual. None. And he testified to this under oath. When they walked in, one of the things that happened is that, according to the evidence, one of the things that Daniel Rodriguez said, and yes, if we are going to talk about everything so you can make a full decision, he did curse. And so that the record is complete, he said, "Where's your fucking warrant?" or "Where's your motherfucking warrant?" One of those two things. Yes, it was disrespectful to police, but if that were the case, then we wouldn't have cases such as the ones that say the First Amendment allows you to say that. We have a case that somebody wore a t-shirt in court that said, "Fuck the draft," and that was found to be a freedom of speech. So just because, and I point that out, that just because somebody curses at police does not give them a right to escalate the situation and does not give them a right to shoot, did not give Richard Chrisman the right to shoot. And yes, that is what the evidence showed. That's included in the transcript. And when he said that, Richard Chrisman, rather than trying to de-escalate the situation as they are trained to do, took his gun out, not stuck it, didn't do anything like that, hit with a muzzle on the temple, hit Daniel Rodriguez in the muzzle and said, "Here's your motherfucking war. Here, I got it for you right here." Does that sound like the saint that they've been portraying to you? It does not. I submit to you that it does not. And so, at that point, Mr. Rodriguez backs away, and this is according to the other officer that was there, started to back away. Was never a threat, was never armed, there was a dog that was there. Junior, as you've been told, at some point, the hitting to the temple was the aggravated assault charge. And to be clear, the jury found him guilty of that, a class 3 dangerous felony. So when they talked about him bleeding, he didn't just bleed. He was found guilty, and they hung on a second degree murder charge and on the misconduct or the cruelty to animals charge. But they did find him guilty. A group of 12 citizens said that that was not acceptable, whether it's under the officer standard, whether it's under the Warren Granville standard, whatever standard that was given to them under the jury instructions, they found that it was not reasonable, and that police officer should not have hit that citizen on the side of the head. That not only was a crime, it was a breach of his duty, even though they claimed he was the best officer that they had ever known. And that's what the witnesses have told you, and you must consider the other side. At that point, it escalates even further.
There's a tasing that goes on. It does not have an effect. The reason it doesn't have an effect is subject to dispute. It could be that one of the prongs of the taser didn't go in, or it could be another reason. Don't know why. But after that, as Daniel Rodriguez, the forgotten one, stood there with his hands up, Richard Christman escalated the situation further when there was no threat to him, according to the other officer, Sergio Virgil. He was there. He was seeing everything that was being done. According to Richard Christman, well, this other officer actually is his fault. Talk about not taking responsibility for your actions. What they're telling you here is, no. The fault in this particular case lies with Sergio Virgil because he didn't back him up. You heard that here today. Left him out to dry. No, he did not. According to the testimony, Sergio Virgil was trying to calm the situation down because he did not foresee any threat. And it was at that point, when he did not foresee any threat, when the victim was standing with his hands up, Richard Christman shot him in front. And then as he turned, shot him again. Those are the facts, as we know them in this particular case, that were presented to a jury, and the jury decided that that was not what a reasonable police officer would have done in that case, at least as to the aggravated assault. The other charge, the murder charge, there was no agreement. It was a hung jury. They've also talked about the saint as having a wonderful life, having this wife Ingrid. Well, one of the things that perhaps they forgot to tell you, they didn't speak to Ingrid about it, but his ex-wife was that one time she was in the bathroom, and as she told the story to Detective Alex Familia of the Maricopa County Attorney's Office, well, she was in there, and he takes a gun, and he threatens to kill her. Doesn't sound like too much like a saintly thing to do under any circumstances, yet they want you to believe that this individual is a great father, a great husband. Not so much so if you're threatening somebody with a gun. And at that point, he even turned the gun and, according to her, put it in his mouth to pull the trigger. So again, when you're thinking about these things, it's a good idea to look at the other side. And with this, you heard from some of his family members who said that he was happy and really looking forward to becoming a police officer. Well, one of the things that we know, some of you may have some experiences in this, is that you have to take what's called a polygraph, a lie detector test. He didn't pass it because he lied. He made things up. Did not pass that. And according to his wife, Ingrid, one of the things that he did is that he practiced the answers so that the next time that he took it, he was fortunate enough to take it, he could pass it. So this is the individual that they're presenting to you, one that does not pass the polygraph test. This individual that then practices how to answer these particular questions. The other thing that we know is that they hold him up as an exemplary police officer and say that, well, perhaps the standard should be different because people of color in South Phoenix, not the ones in OLTP, mind you, but the other ones. And there was a phrase that was used. According to, I think, initials of A.J. Bob, I think was his name, indicated, quote, they had a different way. Now, when you say you have a different way, what you're saying is that you're treating people differently. It's the same thing as saying, well, yeah, you know, the facilities are the same. There are bathrooms are blacks, and bathrooms are whites, but they're the same. It's a little different location. Or in sitting on the bus. Well, you can sit in the back of the bus. You just can't sit in the front of the bus. According to AJ, the person who came up here, sort of misspoke a little bit, said you have a different way of dealing with people in South Phoenix. And that was the attitude that Richard Christman had, not only as told by the police officer that indicated today, but through the mother who told you what Mr. Christman told her at that time. And another thing about this way of enforcing the law, this different way by the saint, one of the things that there is out there, uncontroverted videotape out of 7th Avenue in Jefferson, just down the road. I spoke about this a little bit last time, but in that
videotape. What actually happened was that somebody from the medical examiner's office was sitting there looking around the premises. Because, as you know, that's the area where the homeless are, and they have to be careful about these people perhaps sleeping there. And he noticed that there was a police car, and he noticed that there was somebody that they had stopped. At first, he didn't pay too much attention to it, but then it caught his attention at the way they were treating a citizen. Perhaps that citizen had no health issues, but does that entitle them to treat her in a different way because of the atmosphere? Or it was because she was African-American that they were allowed to treat her that way? But there can be no mistake that Richard Crisman went to the trunk of his car, got an item, whether it was a pipe or cocaine, no one's really, we believe it may have been just a cocaine or a crack pipe. Don't know exactly what it was. And the woman is being held by another police officer, female. And Richard Crisman gives that other officer this. And it's on video. So they can't say it didn't happen. They can't say it's subject to interpretation that perhaps it was a saintly thing to do. Perhaps they wanted to, they can turn it around and spin it and say that they wanted to give her lodging for that night. Perhaps you can say that. But there are different ways to do it. And Richard Crisman gave that to the other police officer in her right hand who planted it on this person. Does that sound like the police officer that they've been describing to you? No, it does not. Does it sound like the saint that they've been portraying to you? No, they haven't. It doesn't look that way. One of the other things that must be kept in mind is that people have different opinions about what happened, and perhaps they have different roles. In this particular case, we do know that there was a jury, and as we all know, that is really what sets America apart from other countries. We don't have one individual and judge make the decision. We have people from the community that make these decisions. They are entrusted with that duty. And that's what happened in this case. And I know that there's a letter from the judge in this case, but his job, by definition, is different than that of the jury. His job is to make sure that the proceedings are fair to both sides. It is not to make a judgment in this case. This was a trial to a jury, not to a judge. So when I read his letter, and it says, for example, I presided over a 23-day trial in this matter where a jury found Mr. Crisman guilty of aggravated assault, 3 dangerous NR, not repetitive, for pointing his service weapon at the victim. He's wrong. The transcript is out there. But what this also goes to, and I'm not saying, I'm not being critical of him or anything, but one of the things that we know now is that since he has written a letter on behalf of the defendant, that's an indication of bias. There's, if, for example, for whatever reason, this case were to be appealed, and it wasn't appealed, the defendant had the opportunity to appeal the aggravated assault conviction, and he chose not to do that. But if it were to be appealed and it came back for reasons, this judge could not do it. And he couldn't do it because he has now spoken on behalf of the defendant. And that's a conflict of interest. I point that out because I want you to consider his letter in that light. Because now he's not, even though he is a judge, he's speaking to you as an advocate, just like A.J. Baba, just like Maria, his wife. They become advocates on behalf of somebody, and it's not entitled to any more or any less way than someone who has an interest or a bias. And that's what he indicates here. According to him, the judge, he imposed a concurrent mitigated term of 7 years and 5 years in the Department of Corrections. My sentence was based on my perception that while the jury's finding that Mr. Crisman's conduct related to the aggravated assault charge was objectively unreasonable, the jury said it was unreasonable, his subjective intent was never malevolent. Now he's acting as a fact finder for you. That wasn't one of the questions that was put before the jury. That was not at all. But he's now making that finding, and that goes to his bias in this case. He, the letter goes on, perceived a duty and the authority to remove the victim from a small trailer and came upon a larger and agitated person who was surprised and unwilling to be removed. And it's interesting that he writes in this letter that in the victim's home, in an attempt to remove the victim from the home because of information and belief that the victim's grandmother was the homeowner. Ain't no grandmother here. But what does that tell you about somebody who comes to you and gets your opinion? But there ain't no grandmother here. And there wasn't the pointing of the gun. Sure, there was a pointing initially, but there was also the strike to the head. I mentioned that not to be critical. I mentioned it because these are factual inaccuracies, and I will ask that you consider, because at least there's an implication here that perhaps the judge is biased. And I would point that out because there is a law, but I'll read whatever the rest of the before I continue with the point. According to him, the judge, Mr. Chrisman maintains progression of force as he was trained without the support that he believed that he had. And they're talking about Sergio Virgil. What the judge is doing is criticizing Sergio Virgil, saying that he should have had that support. But Sergio Virgil was there, did not believe that he needed to go and shoot this person. The resulting struggle was unanticipated, and then Mr. Chrisman's pointing and firing the service weapon at the victim, resulting in the aggravated assault and manslaughter counts. It actually was a second-degree murder count to start with, if we're going to be accurate about it. And he adds, and I suspect that this is something that you took into account when you made the decision to pass this to a phase two. As I mentioned at the time of sentencing, I would have imposed a less harsh sentence as the law allowed. Well, there's a section called 603L, isn't there? If he thought that this was excessive, he could have. This judge could have made a recommendation in that sense, but he didn't. And he does have the ultimate power in this case. He could have rejected the plea agreement and said, no, I think it's unduly harsh. Not going to accept it. It happens. I was saying frequently, but it happens. And he could have done that if that's how he felt back then. But he didn't do it in this particular case. And there was an issue as to whether or not the plea agreement was discussed at length with Mr. Chrisman, somehow indicating that perhaps it was unfair the way it was presented, and there was a mention of a lunch hour. Did Mr. Chrisman say that? I didn't hear him say that. I heard a lawyer say that. And what I know, because I was part of the plea negotiations, that's not the way it happened. There was, as you can tell from the date of the conviction in September until December when he was actually sentenced, there's much time in between. And the plea, without getting into the specifics about it, who said what, there was talks. There were talks between the parties. So there wasn't this hurry up and get it done kind of thing that has been portrayed to you. It wasn't like that. He had time from the state's perspective. And if he hadn't had time, he could have told the judge, I need time to consider this. But he didn't do it. And so we're now left with an idea that somehow the state was overbearing in its bringing forth of this charge. Additionally, what he could have done, had he felt that it was appropriate, he could have gone to trial, as was his right. He could have done it. But, as you heard from these other people, the risk of going to trial was perhaps too great for him. But no one stopped him from exercising his rights. So, again, not only is he a saint now, now we have to feel sorry for him, because according to them, he has PTSD, and he has some sort of emotional issues. Well, I would think that at minimum, if you shoot another armed man to death, that at least that could be some of the consequences. And so it strikes me as not perhaps ringing so compassionate for them to again keep focusing on Mr. Crisman and not only on what happened, but to come forth and tell you some of these other things that he has been involved in. And I understand that this is a matter where there's advocacy that takes place, and perhaps sometimes we don't detail as much as we should have. And they talk about his prison conditions. I remember at the previous hearing, the way they described it, it was horrible that he was wherever it is that he is, how his incarceration was. And that he somehow has to stay on campus. My understanding is that you've been convicted of murder, and manslaughter is murder here in the Department of Corrections, and I mean, you won't. You don't get to go off campus either. So what difference does that make where he is? The other thing is that he does have a job. According to them, he does have a job. It's not like he's in his cell like they portrayed in all these hours. He's just like any other prisoner wherever it is that he's being housed. And so one of the things that I guess what I would like for you to keep in mind as you make this decision is that what you have in front of you, if Elvira Fernandez is going to be believed, you have a racist who somehow wants you to think of things differently. According to his ex-wife, he abused a woman, or at least that woman he abused her. And this is an individual that it seems on his tumor's benefit he will be less than truthful as he was on the polygraph. And once he makes it to be a police officer, well, what does he do? He's on video planting evidence. Maybe he thought it was funny. I don't see anything funny when I think that's on somebody. And so what do you have? Well, that's the individual that you are now going to be asked to recommend to the governor that he be shown some clemency, if you will. One of the things that I would also like to consider perhaps is a requirement before you send this to the governor is that in terms of future sentences, I wasn't quite certain that when you passed it from phase one to phase two that you made a finding that the sentences were clearly excessive. And I don't usually practice it, but I didn't hear that last time, and I don't know if that's what you're required to do. So that in order for the record to be clear, if that's what's required, I ask that you make a finding that the sentences were clearly excessive before, and then now we can then go forward that on that basis. And based on everything that was presented to you today, that the governor should perhaps show clemency to this individual. Obviously, given my tone and given what I've told you, or not told you, what I've urged you, I am requesting that you turn his request down. Not because anybody wants to be hard-hearted, but because the facts, what happened at the scene, the individual himself, who he is, and what he has done, and especially what he did on duty. It wasn't like he just had one bite of the apple and shot this person, and it never has happened. We have him on video engaging in misconduct. And so for those reasons, I am asking that you deny his request today.
Thank you so much, sir. Question, board members.
Yes,
Honorable Mr. Gowanis.
I have one question, and it comes from a position of great respect for what you do. You were involved in the plea negotiations?
I was, along with other people in the office. It went as high as the county attorney, I believe. I know that the person that was involved was the division chief, and I assume, and my understanding is that he spoke to the county attorney.
Understood and much respected. If I'm not mistaken, Mr. Crisman already has an unreleased credit date of September 16, 2019, which is less than 2 years away. I don't think that's something that your office has any control over in terms of what happens inside the correction system. In your opinion, was there already clemency granted with such a low prison sentence?
If we talk about, and I'm reluctant to sort of give my opinion, but I can say that based on my observations, if an individual is convicted of this type of crime, the sentence, of course, it's a
punishment. I'm sorry, may I interrupt you for just 1 second? I'm sorry, I didn't mean clemency. I meant leniency, sufficient leniency. Pardon me, because I know that's what we represent.
Right. In these circumstances, what we usually have is an individual, when they get a plea, they're either charged with first degree or second degree murder, and then, for whatever reason, there's a plea to a manslaughter charge, such as here. So, what I have seen, and this is based on experience rather than a specific case, is that it is built in the plea offer that we have taken into account the specifics of that particular case that may warrant less years. So it is taken into account when the offer is made.
Thank you, Councilman.
Thank you.
Councilman, may I just ask a few questions? Well, I wanted to ask this of the mother, but I felt respect for her and her emotions. Did she actually see the shooting, the mother?
My understanding is that she did not see the shooting.
She indicated, I believe, and if I'm in error, please correct me, that when Mr. Chrisman had shot, he came out with his hands up. Is that correct, or is that your understanding, or did I misunderstand that?
I will give background as it was in the police report, and then I will answer your question directly.
Yes, sir.
The police were called. She actually was in another trailer that was to the south, to the north. When the police went to the door, she was outside and could hear what was going on. At some point, she heard everything that happened, and then at some point, she tried to go in the door, but was not allowed to go in. I don't know about the hands up. I do know that years ago when I tried this case, she did mention the issue involving the statements that were made about whether or not they were here legally and the term that was used. She did mention that to me. I believe, and because I don't think there was an order to that effect, but I believe that she did not testify, and so that statement did not come into trial. But to answer your question directly, I didn't talk to her about what she saw because she didn't testify, but I never remember her telling me that she saw him come out with his hands up.
I guess my next question would be, to the best of your knowledge, you may not know, what happened to the other officer after this incident, sir?
The other officer had a horrible time. One of the things that happened is members from the Phoenix Police Department, while he was at the golfing range, came out to visit him and paid him a visit. And they went round and round, there was a short conversation, asking him perhaps if he had more time to think about it, perhaps he could see things differently. When those officers were questioned about why they went out there, they said, well, they were there to return his clipboard. That's why they were out there. So that was part of the problem. The other thing is that when he was finally back in the field, or whatever term they used, he couldn't go out on any call-outs because nobody would go with him. He suffered extreme public embarrassment because we don't know, but apparently somebody leaked to the media that his wife had had an affair, so that was publicized. There were other officers, one in particular that I know, that
even though they were not with the Internal Affairs, I think they call it PSB or whatever they call it, took it upon himself to try to tape record him about an incident and then try to turn it into the Internal Affairs, and then I don't know what happened after that, but that was clearly not appropriate under the protocol for that to happen. So he eventually left the City of Phoenix Police Department as a police officer because he could not be a police officer there.
Now, you mentioned a couple of things that one that predated this incident, and the other one was that I guess both predated this incident. One was I'm not reading it at the moment, but this other situation down the streets from here, his
right.
place in the whatever in the presence of this person who was, I assume was going to be arrested. The other one that you mentioned,
We're not sure she was going to be arrested. She was detained because she obviously hadn't done anything.
Yes, sir, that she was being detained. And the other one that you mentioned that I'm assuming that predated this was his situation with the polygraph, the lie detector that he was that hearsay or is that factual, both?
No, I obtained the records from the Phoenix Police Department as part of my preparation for trial. And the the pre-employment file. And the pre-employment file, it indicated that with regard to the first polygraph that he failed in, and then subsequently to the second polygraph, Detective Alex Medina, who was in our office, interviewed the wife at the time, who indicated to him that she was familiar with that he flunked the polygraph, and that the reason that, according to her, the reason that he flunked the polygraph was that his drug use, and that she cited that she raised it or helped him so that he could then pass the polygraph. So that's based not only on the records that he failed it, but also on his wife telling us why he failed it and what happened after that.
Let me ask another question. Sometimes we read it and sometimes we misread it. But how do we conclude that Mr. Chrisman actually pointed the gun at Mr. Rodriguez? How do we?
We have two points of corroboration. The first one is the officer that was there said that was said, and that's what was done. The other one is the medical examiner, I don't remember his name off the top of my head, who conducted the analysis or the medical examination on the body. What he was able to determine was that there was bleeding in that area and bruising in that area that was apparently murder or happened at or near the time of the killing. So we know, based on what the officer told us, that he struck him on the side of the head with it and uttered those words, and then that was corroborated by the medical examiner who said that he actually had bruising and bleeding underneath the skull.
Thank you, sir. Further questions, board members? Yes, Honorable Mr. Kawanis.
As sensitive as it is, were the racial epithets corroborated by the officer as well?
Because she was not going to be testifying, and also I wanted to be careful not to be in a situation where somebody might say that I would suggest something to somebody, for example, this officer, that, hey, did he say X, Y, and Z, or did he say something? My focus of this prosecution was obviously the second-degree murder charge and the aggravated assault and the cruelty to animals charge. The other stuff, rule is 403, what we call this. If something is unduly inflammatory, if it's kind of way out there, and a jury might be upset that they hear it, then you shouldn't include it. And I was sort of governing myself. And so, no, I never asked that other officer about it. I do know that she did tell me about it before, but I didn't ask him about it. Sergio, I never asked him about it.
Thank you.
Follow questions? Yes, Honorable Mr. Rittenbacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Martinez, what did the toxicology report show in the autopsy?
It did indicate that Mr. Rodriguez, and I don't know whether it was, so I'll say the worst possible case scenario is that he had just ingested, even though I can't say that he had just ingested the methamphetamine, or maybe it was something that had been in the system for some time. I can't say that, but just to be fair to the system, he did have methamphetamine in the system, but you know, I guess I'll add this, and this is a bit gratuitous. We're not in the Philippines, and we just don't go out and kill people just because they ingest methamphetamine. Right. And I understand that perhaps is something that is a source, I guess, of comfort to the defendant that he shot somebody that was high on methamphetamine, but the jury considered it, and even though they knew about it, they still came back with verdicts that they came, the two hung juries, as well as the guilty on the aggravated assault.
And that was the only drug present?
I believe so, but I believe that yes, and I believe that was the one that everybody was sort of focused on.
Okay.
Yes. And to be fair, I don't know if it indicated a large amount, so let's say it was a large amount or a small amount, but definitely it was in the system. I'll even submit to you that it probably was affecting him at that time.
Well, since everyone's physiology is different, nobody can predict how a drug will...
more accurate than my statement.
Right, so... thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Just one final question, sir. To your recollection, was it suggested at all by the Honorable Judge that he would be issuing a 60L, 603L during the plea agreement or at any time in the court proceedings? I mean, because this letter came out this year from the judge, but was it 603L that idea come up at all, to the best of your knowledge?
No, it was never mentioned to me. It was never mentioned at any time during the proceedings. I will say that the minimum sentence for the aggravated assault charge was 5,
yes,
and then the minimum sentence under the aggravated manslaughter was 7, I believe that was. So that really what we were looking at was an extra couple of years after the minimum of what he was already convicted of.
Any further questions, board members? There seem to be no further questions. Thank you, sir. Any?
One of the things that was brought up, and I guess maybe I didn't think it was that important, but the defendant, Mr. Christman, was not in custody during the pendency of these proceedings. It was only after he was convicted the aggravated assault that he was taken into custody. He may have been in custody for a week after he was arrested initially, but then he was out of custody, and under our rules, it's mandatory that if somebody is going to be sentenced to prison, that they shall be taken into custody at the time that the verdict is rendered. So that's why he was taken into custody. Neither the parties do not have discretion at that point.
Okay. Anything else, sir?
No, that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. Okay. Mr. Christman, Mr. Richard Christman, we are coming towards the end of your hearing at this time. As I've stated, this is your hearing. Therefore, we would like to give you and or your attorney the opportunity to make a final statement to the board before the board goes into discussion and then makes its a decision. So at this time, would you like to make the statement, sir, or should we listen to your attorney, or will both of you be making a closing statement, sir?
I believe both of us. I do believe she would like to say something.
Okay. And then you want to speak now or last, sir?
I think I'll speak now.
Okay. This is your hearing, yes, sir. And then she will speak. Okay. Thank you, sir. Please state your name for the record, sir.
My name is Richard Allen Christman.
And what would you like to tell the board at this time, sir?
I'd like to thank the board for even allowing me to get to this point of the process. I'm very grateful for that, regardless of your decision today. I would like to thank everybody who showed up to speak on my behalf. And it's been very emotional to sit here and listen to people speak from the heart about me. It's very difficult to hear all the things they have to say. The board I've heard ask several people about thing I plan to do when I get out, and I will get out, I'm aware of that. If I will grab my wife and my daughter in the most suffocating of embraces, and I will hold them for as long as I can. When I'm finished with that, I will start the process of reconnecting with my wife and children. I will start rebuilding what's been taken from us. I know that in the near future, I will be required to get work to help pay for things at home. I've always worked. I'm a very talented individual. I have a great deal of employment skills. And prior working for the city of Phoenix, I spent 8 years working in structural steel. I think it would be very easy for me to go back to that. However, I think that is something that would be limiting my skills and talents. In the immediate future, I may need to rely on that network of friends and family that sit there before you to help me find a job. And just as a convicted felon, it may be difficult, but I will get a job. I will not sit around and rot. I do plan on going back to school. I have only a couple of classes, actually, before I finish my bachelor's degree. Beyond that, I've considered taking a four-year degree in optometry. As Mr. Kevin mentioned, he has a great desire to work with me, helping me rebuild and start anew. And I look forward to that process. I look forward to flying out to Minnesota and seeing my sons and reconnecting with those two. In general and in summary, I look forward to turning the page on this dark and difficult time in my life. I will move forward. I will move upward. And I will not be defined by a single moment in my life. I thank you all for this opportunity. And with that, I'll turn it over to my attorney.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am. Please state your name again for the record.
Julia Castles on behalf of Richard Chrisman. I just have a few things to say in response to Mr. Martinez and his presentation. As was noted, it was the victim, Dana Rodriguez's mother, who called police that day for assistance. She called for domestic violence. As she said, she and her son had gotten into an altercation. He was yelling, and that he threw something sharp at her, which missed her but left a hole in the wall. Her son was under the influence of methamphetamine. That was demonstrated through the autopsy. I believe everyone is aware that methamphetamine leads people to act in unpredictable and in dangerous ways. In regard to whether Mr. Chrisman may have used a racial slur toward her, may have asked her about if she spoke English, I submit to you his wife Maria is Mexican. Her children are of Mexican descent. I'm holding up a picture of her daughter, Angie. It's untenable to me that he would use that phrase when he had been with Maria for a significant amount of period of time right then. So I'd ask the board to discount those. And further, you asked Mr. Martinez if he ever had spoken to anyone about that, and he said that he had not. Mr. Martinez also brought up some incidences that allegedly occurred with Mr. Chrisman's ex-wife, Ingrid, at some point. There are absolutely no details provided as to that. And I will note for you that the divorce, it was very, very difficult on both sides. And in fact, Mr. Chrisman's former wife, as you've heard, had relocated her children to Minnesota. It's an acrimonious situation. I would ask the board not to give her statements great weight. In addition, in regard to failing a polygraph, of course, there are many reasons why people fail polygraphs. It is not necessarily that someone is lying. It may well be some other issue. We simply do not have enough information about that in order to make any kind of a judgment call on that. Mr. Martinez has also brought up an incident that occurred that resulted in either in an internal affairs investigation or a Professional Standards Bureau investigation. That is an incident that stems from October of 2006, so over 11 years ago at this point. It stems from a call that Mr. Chrisman had been sent out on. And then as they were leaving that call, they came upon a woman who was well known to them, who was known to have a misdemeanor warrant. It's a woman they had a long relationship with, as they had booked her into custody many times, unfortunately. And in fact, when they booked her into, went to book her into custody on her warrant, this woman actually said, "I'm probably going to get home before you do." They had that sort of a familiarity between each other. The allegations regarding planting evidence on her was, in fact, submitted to the Maricopa County Attorney's Office, where Mr. Martinez works, and it was not charged. That incident was never charged. The Maricopa County Attorney's Office declined prosecution, did not believe that there was something worthy of further investigation. Instead, Mr. Chrisman and his partner at the time were given 8 hours of unpaid leave. They both apologized profusely and had never been any other allegation of misconduct until the time of this. I would also like to address the issue of the plea agreement. Mr. Martinez seemed to indicate to the board that if Mr. Chrisman were feeling pressured or rushed, that he could just ask for more time. That's not how it works. The prosecution is able to set deadlines and make those deadlines firm. I've been practicing criminal defense here in Maricopa County for over 15 years. I can tell you, I have many, many clients who have requested that they have more time to think about a plea offer. I can tell you that many, many times the state's response is, no, we're proceeding to trial if you don't accept a plea. Mr. Chrisman felt an extreme amount of pressure in order to, as Maria described, make a choice between 20, 25 years or the possibility that he will see his children again before they are completely adults. So yes, of course he felt pressure. No one's saying that the state put undue pressure on him or that he was strong-armed into accepting a plea, but the decision that he had to make is a huge one. It's a life-changing type of decision. Mr. Martinez also seemed to indicate that the Honorable Judge Granville is somehow biased. Judge Granville, in fact, presided over the entirety of the case. He observed all the witnesses. He heard all the testimony. And given that he did accept the plea agreement, he is, in fact, then a finder of fact. It is no longer to the jury's hands. Judge Granville did not issue a 603L letter, meaning one that would be issued shortly after the time of sentencing. Instead, I, in fact, went and approached Judge Granville, indicated that all of the appeal periods were far past, and would he be willing to write a letter to the board. He was most gracious and grateful to be able to do so, and said he'd actually thought of Mr. Chrisman often, as he knew he was the type of inmate that was going to have a very, very difficult sentence. Just for the board's edification, after a trial, a defendant has 20 days to appeal. After entering into a plea agreement, a defendant has 90 days to file a petition for post-conviction relief. Those would have all passed in 2011, and this letter, of course, was written in May of this year. So there's no indication that there was any kind of bias, and Judge Granville has been on the bench for a very long time. So I think that that is just frankly not something that we need to consider. Mr. Martinez also seemed to indicate that Mr. Chrisman is just another prisoner. He certainly is not. The safety concerns alone. He's in fear for his life every single day. Whether it be an inmate that discover his true identity, whether it be from a guard, it's a completely different situation. As we've been sitting here this morning, I attempted to calculate how long he's been in custody. And while I don't proclaim that I'm capable of doing math, which is why I'm a lawyer. It's my estimation that he served over 1,500 days in custody. Every day, wondering if his safety can be assured. Every day, without having any contact in a physical nature whatsoever with his family, with his friends, with his children. He's lucky that he has very committed friends and former colleagues who have been keeping up the weekly phone calls with family who's willing to drive hours and hours and hours to go see him through a glass wall, and shortly it will be hours and hours and hours to see him over a video monitor once the facility he is in changes to pure video conferencing for visits. As I mentioned a minute ago, I've practiced criminal defense law for over 15 years. Many of my clients are people who make terrible choices. Most of them are people who are affected by drugs and alcohol, by mental health issues. Richard Christman is entirely unlike any other client I have ever represented, and I expect that I will ever represent. He is clearly a man who is committed to his family. He is a man who made a severe mistake, and who has paid a very, very, very high price. There is no other client of mine that I could come in and say with a straight face that they will not reoffend. I do not believe there's any way Mr. Christman can reoffend. He does not have the character for that. So I'm asking the board to forward his case to the governor. I will show you briefly a couple of photos. This is a family photo that was taken in Santa Monica of Rich, his wife, and the kids. A school picture from 2016 of stepdaughter. And then there's also pictures of his boys. I really believe that Mr. Christman has been severely punished in this turn of events. And it is not missing from anyone's mind the impact upon Ms. Fernandez, and that her son Daniel lost his life. However, on behalf of Mr. Christman's sons, Jacob and Joshua, his daughter Jennifer, daughter Angie, his wife Brianne, as well as Nancy, and the rest of the friends and family who are gathered here today, we are asking you to forward Mr. Christman's file to the governor. Let the governor make a decision in this matter. And I have nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. At this time, the board is going into discussion. It may sound as if we're talking to you, Mr. Christman, or to others who are present. We're not. We're just talking among ourselves, the three of us. Following this discussion, the board will make its determination. The board will vote. As I stated up front, we do operate under the open meeting law of the state of Arizona. Therefore, everything that we do say will be done in public. We will not exit this room. We will do it right here. While you're listening and observing, the three of us. So at this time, the board is going into discussion. I'm going to ask that everyone would remain respectful of each other. I'm going to ask that everyone would remain respectful of the board. We know that sometimes this can be emotional, but we're going to ask that each of us remain calm and respectful. The board is now in discussion. Any board member wishes to lead off this discussion? In honor of Ms. Rittenhouse.
Thank you, sir. I make all my comments with all respect to Mr. Rodriguez and Ms. Fernandez and Mr. Christman and his family and the attorneys who have worked on this case. All respect. I understand from testimony we've heard today, Mr. Christman has been a good prisoner, model prisoner, and I can tell you from 27 years that I worked in corrections, the time he's serving is different from other inmates. Not only because of the visits and the contact with the lack of contact with the family because of the distance, but because of the constant knowing that if his identity is revealed, he's in critical danger. So it is different. I mean, no matter what anyone says, it is different. I believe it was attorney Craig Marins who wrote a letter explaining that Mr. Christman does accept his punishment. He realizes that, you know, he was convicted on this, especially the aggravated assault. He accepts his punishment for that. And he is responsible for his actions and doesn't argue with that, does not argue at all. And that he has conducted himself in a very classy way, actually, regarding this. As for the plea, I find it significant that there was a mistrial and even the jury could not agree after hearing all the details, of which we've certainly read everything that has been written, but hearing all of that, even the jury could not agree. And that whether or not there was a time limit on the plea agreement, I don't know. I mean, I accept what I hear from both sides. But Mr. Crispin's perception was at the time, whether it was based on sleep deprivation, lack of meals, whatever it was based on, his perception was that he had some kind of a time limit. And he felt that I read in some of this information, he read that he couldn't consult with the people he wished he could have consulted with. He had limited access to the people who would have been his mentors that he could have asked for advice. So I'm taking that into account. As far as whether Mr. Christman is a racist, I noticed when his own wife came up to the mic, she speaks with an accent that suggests that English is not her first language. So I'm not believing that he is a racist, just based on that. I also consider carefully Judge Granville's letter. And our experience has been on this board even, that not all judges are aware of the 603L and that has to be done within a certain number of days. I'm not sure. I wasn't there, so I don't know if the judge was even aware of it. But I certainly, because of his experience, his tenure as a judge, he certainly heard many, many cases. Judge Granville heard this whole trial, and whether or not he was serving as an advocate or not, he stated in his own letter he felt that Mr. Christman was using his training, that his actions were taken based on his training, that he would have, and the judge said he himself would have given a lesser sentence if he had been allowed to do that by law. So I based on what I've heard from Mr. Christman himself and his supporters, I don't believe Mr. Christman will ever reoffend. I don't think that's a consideration at this time. But I'm certainly open and willing to listen to information from my colleagues.
Mr. Gordes?
Thank you, Mr. Board Chairman, and thank you, Ms. Rittenhouse. That was a really good beginning to the discussion. And I will say that this is a very challenging case because it's fundamentally a very tragic case. There's a real victim, a traumatized family, and on the other hand, a very traumatized community surrounding the former police officer. He's certainly serving his prison sentence right now. I asked some questions. I asked some unpopular questions, I think, along the way, just to get a feel for the totality of the case. And this will probably be one of the more unique cases that I preside over as a voting board member. I will say that there's a lot of angles here. The reason why I had voted individually to pass it to phase two is after hearing what we did the first time, was considering the totality of what we knew at that point, leading up to the shooting incident. And there was an expression used today here that I thought was interesting, and that was the, it's just an expression, but dog years, that somehow the years he was serving in the prison system were different than the typical flat sentence. But that's balanced, and this is not in the face of the prosecution team, but the fact that there was a conviction, there was a crime. And I heard what was said by the Maricopa County Attorney's Office about some of the offsets to that time, but I still do take into consideration as well that at the end of the day, the plea agreement was pretty lenient. It was a short sentence. It was 7 years, or what could have been much, much longer than that. So in that balance, I will say that I think it's, I find some meaning that Mr. Crisman has served quite a bit of his sentence already. He's been serving his time. He's certainly been made an example of. His behavior in the system has been exceptional. I was trying to put into context how much of that time he'd already served, which is I'd say close to 2/3 of his sentence, close to it anyways. So I'll just bring it to a close by saying that I'm open to a recommendation to the governor's office, but as we learned some months ago, we're in the disappointment business. You can't please everybody with these types of decisions. You have to make hard decisions. We're asked to deliberate on the spot based on the totality of the case. And I believe, based on the fact that he already has an early release credit date that's less than 2 years ago, less than 2 years to go, if we were looking at a case that was for life or natural life or death, I'd be looking at it much differently. But it was already pled down to a low amount, and he's serving some very difficult time as a former police officer. And I defer to you.
Thank you so much, Cornish, as well as Ms. Rittenhouse, for your profound observations. First of all, I want to thank all of the participants today. I thank everyone for being respectful of the board. I think that this is a very different and interesting commutation here in for this board. That's phase two. I think that, as it's been indicated, it seems that what we've heard is hearsay, some observant, some, we don't know where some of it was coming from. But I think that everybody has been very professional in terms of what they had to offer. I think in phase one, this board made a determination to pass it to phase two based upon information that was presented to this board at that time. Here we are at phase two. The board must make the determination whether to pass this to the governor or the governor's determination whether to provide clemency or not. I think that we can never forget, as board members, the victims, the victim in this, well, the victims, because each time it's more than one victim. To be sure, Mr. Rodriguez was the victim. He was the one who was murdered. There is a mother. There are others out there, family and friends. This must weigh very heavily upon them. We also have to consider the offender. We have to also consider, in my opinion, the profession of the defendant. He was a police officer. He had real responsibility as an officer of the law.
As the information that's been presented to this board, both written as well as oral, there were two officers present, sworn officers. They just happened to have seen it different. One felt that perhaps his life was in danger. The other one felt that his life was not in danger. Unfortunately, the other officer is not present. He has not, this is not a criticism, but he's not present. And to the best of my knowledge, we do not have a written statement from the other officer. We do have information in the police report, but for the purpose of this hearing, we do not have a statement. Should this board send a letter to the governor? I think that I, for one board member, I could lean either way because this is really not an easy one. But I think in view of all that we've heard and all that we've had the opportunity to review, I will concur with my distinguished colleagues and recommend a letter to the governor, but I want to see if there's anything else that a board member wish to add before we go forward. This is not a final determination yet.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Board Chairman. This is one thing I forgot to say because I had written down a lot of notes, and I really hear what you have to say about, I know it's not what you said exactly, but there's a very fine line here between clemency and accountability in this case. I think one of the things that stood out to me that I was very curious about, because it was not information that was complete the first time, but that is that regarding Mr. Grisman's past, and I know that there was a disciplinary issue that I found very disturbing. I will say, as a former law enforcement officer and the son of a Phoenix police officer, the idea of planting evidence, let alone unjustified or excessive force, is something that there are some cases that I've heard in this country that make me want to throw a plate across the room when I think about how an officer has dishonored the profession. But when the information was provided that that incident was not accepted by the Maricopa County Attorney's Office and ended in a day off, I know from my personal experience that incidents up to the level that I'm thinking of are not day off incidents. They're incidents that end up getting fired or maximum times of discipline extended into the months. For that to result in a day off, I still don't approve of whatever happened. But I know the difference between a day off, 2 weeks off, a month off, and fired. So it was important to me to get the rest of that story as well. Thank you, Mr. Board Chairman.
Thank you. Any further discussion? If not, I would just go ahead and offer a motion. And the motion is to recommend to the governor that Mr. Christman be considered for clemency. That is my motion.
I'll second.
Agreed.
Motion by Wright, seconded by Honorable Ms. Rittenhouse, agreed by Mr. Kiwanis. The board will send a recommendation to the governor. I'm going to ask Ms. Rittenhouse, and she's the first one to speak, if she would draft the letter and have it on the chairman's desk by the 21st of December, and then we will process it and get it over to the governor's office. Once again, we want to thank all of you for your participation. Once again, we're going to ask, as we ask it, victims this way, south, advocates this way,
did you mention
setting
the time
for the governor? No, we did not set a time for the governor.
You have to set the times.
What is the time for the governor?
Whatever you're recommending for the reduction of the sentence. It's your recommendation for the reduction of the sentence.
But we can't tell the governor when.
No, that's what we do.
so he knows that. And then you make the recommendation that anything you go with it will change over time, but you have to do that.
Okay. The executive director said that we have to make a recommendation to the governor when to do it. I don't see this on this form, but what would be the recommendation that the governor should react to the letter that we will send over to the governor's office?
Does that mean give him a date by which he needs to respond?
Yeah, that which he needs to respond. We've not done that before, but I the
30 days.
The executive director has.
I'd say only realistically 60 days.
Okay, 60 days. Okay, 60 days that the governor will respond. But remember, we cannot tell the governor when to respond.
Mr. Chairman, what I'm referring to is typically when you make the motion, you say, I recommend to the governor that the sentence be commuted to time served or a reduction of 5 years. You have to indicate the length of time.
So the time is as stated. The time as stated by the Department of Corrections on the application itself.
2.5 years. Two years, 5 months.
2 years, 5 months is what we would be recommending. And that was just a given in my opinion because it's already on the form that we have, that this was his request. And unless the board was altering this request, is there any alteration to this request? If there's none, then we're talking about a reduction of 2 years and 5 months. Anything else before the board adjourns? If not, this will end this hearing. The board will reconvene at 12:45. Thank you.
Thank you.